Can everybody take their seats, please?
Wow, that worked. First of all, good morning. My name is Aubrey Lane, and I'm the new Secretary of Transportation for the Commonwealth. I'd like to welcome you all this morning to the workshop meeting of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. Before we get started, I'd like to all of you to join with me in standing and say our Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Well, it certainly is an exciting day. Today marks the first CTB meeting under the leadership of Governor Terry McAuliffe and his administration. We're privileged to have a governor who takes seriously the positive impact that transportation decisions have on our Commonwealth. And I've had the chance over the last 30 days during the transition to work with him, and he's very much in tune with the issues. As you all know, if you followed, he campaigned on transportation and making it better for our citizens. One of the things is very key to us is that we will be good stewards of this new money that has been presented to us from our legislature. There was a lot of political capital used to get those monies, and so I want to make sure we use them wisely and actually get something done so that our taxpayers see that their efforts of having to pay a little more do bear fruit. We again find ourselves in the situation to have this money and overseeing it. I will make the comment, though, it's not enough. So prioritization and competitiveness will be a part of our plan going forward, but we are blessed that at least in terms of being able to have some resources to use, this board will make some very important decisions, I know, over the next 4 years to the Commonwealth of Virginia. I'd like to say I'm personally glad to serve with all of you. I was just a few seats down a couple of months ago. And I figured out that I could not bypass Cord to get to the end because he was senior on me, except I sort of cheated and went out of rotation in that regard. But that's the only way I could have gotten to be here. But I'm pleased to be here, and I'm very honored to work with all of you. I've had a chance to speak with the governor. He understands the important work and the respect he has for this board and the business acumen and the responsibility to our citizens. So I am very privileged to serve with you and look forward to working with you over these next years. Now, before we get started, I'd like to recognize a few people. First of all, I'd like to have Greg Worley come up, please. Mr. Worley here? Well, yeah. Mr. Worley make a few remarks. We all recognize him as our former Commissioner of Highways. Greg has served for many years, and in the last four at least, in terms of leading this institution, being a great part of the success that's happened here in the state of Virginia for transportation, not only in implementing the projects, but also being involved with legislation and making sure that things were done properly and efficiently. He had to steward us through some difficult times when we were coming through not having these monies and making some hard decisions. And he got lots of letters thanking him for doing that. I'm just being facetious in that. But he deserves all the credit. Greg has graciously agreed to stay on a couple months to help with the transition and to, not only with VDOT, but also me personally in the Secretary's office. And I'm grateful for him doing that, and I just want to recognize your great service to the state. And, Greg, I'll give you a chance to say a few comments, if you would, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Knowing that you have a very tight agenda, I will be brief. But I just want to say it has been an honor working with the Commonwealth Transportation Board, and Jolly, the new commissioner. We've accomplished a lot over the last few years, and I am very proud of the things that we have accomplished. It was a lot of hard work, and you guys provided a lot of advice and counsel on how we get to the point where we are today. And I look forward to offering advice during your public comment period as a citizen of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And I'm going to take great pride in doing that and enjoyment.
After the next two months.
It has been an honor to have worked with the Commonwealth Transportation Board. We've accomplished a lot, and I am very thankful for having that opportunity. Thank you, Chairman.
Well, Joe, that's really a great Thank you all very much, and thank you, Mr. Worley, again for all your service. I'd like to, before I introduce the new leadership, I'd like to also take a minute and thank, I don't see her, Thelma Drake, for her fine service as Director of Rail and Public Transit. She did a fine job for the 4 years. We made some great strides, and I just want to have on the record that the Commonwealth Transportation Board in the state is very appreciative of her service, and we wish her well and hope to see her in the future. Now, we do have a few new faces here that I'd like to introduce. First of all, and I'll start in the Secretariat. I have a couple of deputies that will be assisting me this year. Very pleased to announce first Nick Donahue will be serving as a Deputy Secretary. And Nick, you want to take a couple minutes to just say something about yourself?
Thank you, Mr. Secretary, and thank you, members of the board. I'm really looking forward to this opportunity. Transportation is a passion of mine, and it's what I've been doing my entire professional career, and so I'm looking forward to working with all of you all over the next 4 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You'll see a lot of him.
I like that, actually. You'd already.
I know. He has. So our other deputy is Brinley Johnson, which you've known before, working at VDOT, and Brinley will also be serving as a deputy secretary, and while we're still working out total responsibilities, Nick will be handling a lot of legislative, although we'll have crossover, and Brinley, I'm happy to say, will be helping me a great deal with community outreach to legislators, local officials on our major projects and major programs across the state. We have two things that we hope to achieve. One will be that people will always be informed. They may not like what they're informed, but they will be informed, and we will be upfront listening. And Grinley is going to be helping me accomplish that. So, Ms. Johnson, appreciate it. Say a few words about yourself, please.
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Good morning, CTB members. I am very pleased to have this position. It's an honor and a privilege to serve Governor McAuliffe. But I could not do this without my VDOT family. They have prepared me for this. I give a lot of thanks to former commissioner, it's hard for me to say that, former commissioner Gregory Worley. Thank you very much. And to our new commissioner, Charlie Kilpatrick. So with the two of them, I feel that I'm prepared for the task, and I look forward to continuing serving you. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Gregory. So now it's no secret who our next commissioner of highways will be, and I'm pleased to announce that it is Charlie Kilpatrick. Many of you have known Charlie. He was the deputy commissioner, had been at VDOT before that, also been in the private industry. I'm elated that he has accepted the position. We welcome him in, and he'll be serving not only as that, but as vice chair of this commission. And Charlie, I'll ask you to say a few words, please.
And as former Commissioner Worley said, to be brief, my background is largely in the field over my career, and so I have a keen understanding of the challenges that go on, whether it's with local government or with the operations that we do in the field, the construction of projects, the delivery of services. So the focus of the agency will continue to be on solving problems, on delivering great solutions and great services and really improving our relationships with local government, with industry, with other interest groups as we move forward with this tremendous program. I am very honored and humbled to serve as commissioner. It's a great organization, and got a lot of great people that are going to do great things for us in the coming years.
Thank you. Welcome aboard. Assisting Charlie will be a new deputy commissioner, and I'm pleased to announce that will be Quentin Elliott. Quentin has been the district administrator in the Fredericksburg office most recently, and he will bring his talents. He's been all over the system before. His talents is one of the things we embark upon in terms of bringing peoples together and making sure we're more efficient. So, Quentin.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. It is an honor to be selected for this position. I'm looking forward to working with the members of this board and all the VDOT team in delivering our program. I have been with VDOT for 29 years. I've had the privilege of being around most of the state in those 29 years. I've worked in Hampton Roads, Culpeper District, Richmond District, Fredericksburg District. And I grew up in Southwest Virginia, up in the mountains, up in Natural Bridge. So I have a connection to just about all the state of Virginia, and I look forward to working with everyone throughout the Commonwealth and delivering our program. So again, thank you.
Thank you for your service. Yeah. Okay, it also brings me great pleasure to announce our new Department of Rail and Public Transit Director, and that's Jennifer Mitchell. Jennifer comes to us from the Northern Virginia area, has worked at DRPT in the past, and has been at in the private industry. She brings a keen understanding not only of transit, but some freight and really the private industry side of things. So welcome, Jennifer, and please address us if you would.
Sure. Again, my name is Jennifer Mitchell. I am very honored to have this position and working with Secretary Lane and with the McAuliffe administration. As Aubrey mentioned, I've spent the majority of my career in transportation, most recently for the past 10 years or so working exclusively in public transit, primarily on the advancement of major capital projects, both the Dulles Rail Project for many years with DRPT and the Airports Authority, but also a number of major rail projects across the United States. And looking forward to bringing some of that experience and expertise here. And previously in my career, I've also worked in highways and toll roads and ports and airports, so I have a pretty good feel for transportation issues across all modes. So looking forward to working with you all.
Welcome. It'll be easy. There's not many issues in Northern Virginia for you to deal with. So. I'm sorry. I'm not. This was trying to let you know that I do know where Northern Virginia is, and we will be very keen to make sure we're bringing all the resources. In fact, one of the things that Jennifer will be looking at is how do we expand our presence physically in Northern Virginia, because that's such a large part of our transit use up there. I also noticed that we have in the room today our deputy director at DRPT, Mr. Kevin Page. Kevin, you all know, has been with us a long time, brings a world of knowledge, not only in transit, but in freight specifically. He's agreed to stay on as our deputy, and we're glad to have you, Kevin, if you'd like to say a few things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the board. Many of you know me for a long time, 28 years at DRPT and in the transit business as well. I'm looking forward to working with this team. I think we have a lot of great opportunities ahead of us, thanks to House Bill 2313 and the work of TISDAC and the work of the Intercity Passenger Rail Operating Capital Fund, which this Commonwealth Transportation Board has championed both of those projects. I do believe that the Department of Rail and Public Transportation is going to be more collectively as a presence with VDOT in finding transportation solutions and transportation network corridors. We have a lot of challenges before us in the implementation of our new funding as we find out how we can work with our regions who have received also additional funds and how we can work through that both with the Commonwealth Transportation Board and the General Assembly as we work through this session. So thank you, sir, for that.
Thank you very much. Also wanted to inform the members that there will be another appointment, and that is in our Public-Private Transportation Office, the P3 office. We are interviewing candidates for that. That's the one position that we hope to have filled here shortly. Got some great people that we're talking to in that regard as we look forward to how we continue to use that procurement method effectively here in the state. So just to let you know, I'm very extremely excited about our team. We've got a wealth of knowledge, some people coming in with some fresh ideas. So I'm looking forward to working with them and this board as we move Virginia forward in transportation. Yes, Mr. Sterling.
Mr. Secretary, just on behalf of CTB, I want to congratulate you and thank you for assembling the team you have. The experience and professionalism that they'll bring to the job, I think, is great. On behalf of the Fredericksburg District, I would implore you and the senior members at the central office to quit looting my staff, or I'll be filling potholes myself one of these. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. One of the benefits of an early announcement was I've had 30 days to work on this, and the governor and his transition team have been extremely supportive, and I think, as you can see, are dedicated to getting great people in these positions, these important positions for our citizens. So thank you, Mr. Sterling. I see Grinley's back, Ms. Johnson's back in the room. I'd like to now call up the HWA Division Administrator, Irene Rico. She has a presentation she'd like to make. Good morning, Ms. Rico. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Good morning, Charlie Kilpatrick and new commissioner. It's a pleasure, and thank you for this opportunity. I want to extend my appreciation on behalf of the Federal Highway Administration at the national level, as well as at the level of the Virginia Division. I'll start with Ms. Grinley Johnson, and knowing that Mr. Worley is here, if you'll allow me, I would also like to present him with some appreciation from our agency. So I'll start with Ms. Grinley, and I'll be brief.
I'll take your time.
Thank you. just quickly want to say I have had the pleasure and honor of working with Ms. Grinley Johnson and her passion to expand the small business opportunities in the Commonwealth, and because of her passion and dedication to this effort, we in FHWA are recognized for her work and very proud of having part of her team and her efforts. So congratulations, Grinley, and thank you for your passion, and look forward to working with you in your new position. Now, Commissioner Kilpatrick, if you allow me the opportunity to say thank you to Mr. Worley. Mr. Worley, I have known Greg for 11 years, and we looked as young as we did 11 years ago. I want to thank you on behalf of Federal Highway Administration and the Virginia Division for the 25 years of dedicated and exceptional public service to the citizens of the Commonwealth. During your career with the Virginia Department of Transportation, you have served in a variety of positions involving many facets of transportation in Virginia. In particular, to me, in the years that we worked together as partners, you have become a national leader in the advancement of public and private partnerships. Under your leadership, you were successful in reaching several agreements, known mostly as the I-95, the ERC, and 460. During your time, you've also were the first in the whole country to launch a rest area program, which I had the honor to work very closely with you, and we were successful in reaching that agreement. Also, I'd like to recognize your efforts in improving the processes at VDOT, in working with us in the Virginia Division to reduce the inactive funds, which is a national effort in our agency, and for the outstanding response to emergency events in our state, for all the work that we did together, and most importantly, for your partnership and your respect and professionalism. I thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you so much, well-deserved recognition for those individuals. Okay, a couple of administrative things for today before we get started in the workshop. First of all, we do plan to keep the same format that we have continued to do in the past. We'll have a workshop session first, and then we'll have our formal action session. That before the formal session, we will have public comment. But today we'll have a little bit, possibly a change in the schedule depending on where we are. At 1 o'clock today, Governor McAuliffe is going to come over and address the Commonwealth Transportation Board, introduce himself. And before that, I will be presenting under new business, which I think most people here in the audience are here to hear about today, is a toll mitigation plan in Hampton Roads. Wherever we are in the program, we will stop, and if we're not in the session, we will go into workshop session, formal session, have that presentation, so when the governor comes at 1 o'clock, we will have to have that part. I think the way it's timed, we're going to have plenty of time, but I wanted to let people know. So if you're here for public comment and we ask that we push it back, obviously we'll be working towards the governor's schedule. So I think with that, I think that's all the pre-announcements, and we'll begin the workshop session. And our first topic is the quarterly financial update from Mr. Pitter.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome in your new position. And I guess I just want to start. We had a meeting last week, and we talked about the quarterly updates that we provide. And what we said is going forward, we're going to try to put more information in the report that we get to y'all. And it's a time crunch to get you that report because we have to close the books and do a lot of reconciliation. And this month in particular is the board is meeting is as early as it could possibly be in a month, so it really put a lot of pressure. But try to get you the report sooner and put more information in it and make these presentations shorter and more open, or they're open anyway, but more time for questions and less about presenting the details. So this will have a lot of that detail, but going forward each quarter we'll shorten up our presentation and put more in the report. With that, hopefully y'all have gotten the quarterly report, and what I'm going to do is take you through what's in there. The first schedule in there is a schedule that we call Schedule of Resources and Commitments, and it's somewhat like a balance sheet, but it's not full accrual basis. And what it really does is it takes our revenues and our existing assets. And those revenues projected through to the end of the fiscal year, which would be June 30th. And it matches those up to the allocations made against those assets. So like for the current fiscal year, it's taking current year revenues and allocating against those. So that's why we take the revenues through the end of the year. And the net result of those two items is the unobligated balances, which that's where I try to focus y'all's attention, is because that's the money that's available that we could put on projects either through off-cycle grants, or we're getting ready to roll into the secure program application process, and we essentially take the 1231 balances and we'll take that static snapshot and roll those balances into allocating into the current, the 15 six-year program. So I just want to think key for y'all, this is a snapshot. Y'all have a little more detail in your package. But on this slide, this is that statement, and just mainly we'll just focus here that it shows a year-over-year comparison, and the amounts have grown on both resources and unobligated, and that's primarily due to the new revenues from HB 2313 of about $66 million. In transit and about $43 million in rail and 6 months worth of collections of those revenues. And on the rail side, we have the Roanoke project, but those expenditures are projected out in the future years. And on the transit side, we've worked through with y'all over the past few months the TISDAC process and implementing new allocation processes. And so those allocations were made, but the revenues have been coming in, and we haven't distributed any of those funds. Actually, this week we began the distribution process of the allocations that y'all made back in October. And then also on the capital side, there was some funding. Y'all made a decision on the allocation process for 15, and Mr. Cole would confirm this. We decided a while back not to try to go back to our 14 capital projects and add more funding to those due to the nature of the matching commitments that were already established in the six-year program. With that, this slide is the slide where I was trying to focus y'all's attention. These are the balances that are available. We call them unobligated. At the top, that's the chart. I think the one key point I want to make there is there are a lot of different lines there, and the reason for that is these unobligated balances do have certain rules and procedures and code regulations around them. So we can't just take mass transit funds and use them on rail. We can't take rail funds and use them on mass transit. So they are situated on this schedule as different buckets because there are some rules around them. But essentially, these are the balances that are available, as I say below, for off-cycle grants or to roll into the current year six-year program. I do want to note that we did set up the capital allocation process. During that process, we established in the resolution that we were going to have a reserve balance so that the tiers with the matching percentages that y'all established, that we could maintain the percentages that we've published to our transit providers. And so what we want to do is establish a reserve account so that if in any given year the revenues decline or the number of applications we get is greater than what we had projected, that we would have a balance to maintain those stated percentages. So we didn't put that in the resolution. We did put in that we want to have a reserve. We didn't put the specific amount. So we're going to come back next month for an action item for you to go ahead and establish $3.7 million in that reserve account, which is the 5% of the new revenues that we're allowed to establish. And what y'all approved last month was a cap of $10 million on that reserve balance. Next is a slide on our cash balances. Transit continues to work in about a two-month working capital needs. Before it was running a little below this amount. Now it's a little above because we do have the TISDAC money, the new revenues from HB 2313 that has been accumulating and we're getting ready to distribute in January. And this is as of December 31st. On the rail side, I think I had mentioned, it's been a while since I presented one of these quarterly meetings, and I think the last time I was here, I'd been talking about on the rail side that due to the large nature of the projects, they're more complicated, the negotiations are more difficult, and then the size of them vary widely. We can have a $92 million project or a $500,000 project. So due to those items, or for those reasons, I'm going to recommend that I change this needs to a six-month balance. I think that would be more closely aligned. It might not get us right where we need to be, but I think that's a better working capital number going forward. Because we've been, you'll see on the next slide, for the last year and 18 months, I guess this slide shows, we've been way above that three-month working capital reserve. So I think, you know, as I pointed out earlier, the unobligated balance, you know. But I guess the point I'm making here is that we've been above for 18 months a three-month balance. So I think it makes sense to move it to a six-month balance for the reasons I stated. We got a Norfolk train, passenger train project. It was a $110 million project, and the billings on it. And I think, Mr. Miller, you stated this before, that the billings that come in, they come in sporadically. They don't come in each month from that project. So we can go 6 months and not get a bill, and then we all of a sudden get a $40 million bill on the project for the expenditures that have occurred. So anyway, if there's no objection, I'm going to go going forward, push that to a six-month reserve on the rail side. And I guess I'll point out here, on the transit side, there's sort of a dip in this chart because of the 18-month window that's being presented. And what happened was back in 12, we had a contractual problem with our Northern Virginia WMATA jurisdiction. Some of y'all may recall that. We worked through that, and then you see the decline down to the what I would call a more normal range. And then what you see going on the past 6 months on this chart in the orange line is the new revenues accumulating. So we'll be distributing those in the coming months. Also, another item I do want to point out is we do have some contractual issues that were happening this year with Fairfax County, Arlington County. We're working through those now. I'm pleased to report Arlington County, we worked through them. They've signed their contracts as of last week. We distributed, I think, over $12 million already this week on those contracts. And then I know we've set up or we reached out to Fairfax and we're trying to establish another meeting to work through this. Fairfax wants to work through all of their 20 agreements per year together as one block as opposed to individually. So there's two agreements. There's a couple of minor issues that we still need to hammer out. But hopefully in the next quarter, we'll see those agreements executed and the funds will flow. And then rail, I've talked about the lumpiness and the unpredictability of the timing of the cash flows there. And finally, the last part of my presentation is to take you through budget actual for the current year to date. And really, there's one item here that public transit programs are not running at the level of expenditure we thought they would at this point. And the next slide gives the reasons for that. And as I said, the big part of it is Arlington and Fairfax is about $60 million of those contracts that, as I said, we've already started getting Arlington the funds, and hopefully in the quarter we're in right now, we can work out the issues of Fairfax and get those funds flowing too. And other than that, there's a $9 million item that when we did the budget, we thought it would be spent in the current year. It ended up getting paid out before the end of last year, but after we set the budget. So that'll be a permanent reconciling item throughout the year. And then other than that, there's about $20 million of, we have 2,000 transit projects. So of those 2,000 projects, we're going to miss the cash flow estimate on a few of them, and hopefully over time it'll even itself out the rest of the year. And with that, I'll open the floor for questions.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Pittard, I'm not sure I understood the $10 million that was spent in June 2013. In the variance, the third bullet has $9.7 million of capital payments were actually made in June 2013.
Right.
And I'm not understanding why that wouldn't have been in the numbers.
Yes, Mr. Well, let me try to explain it a different way.
Just calendar?
Yeah, well, the fiscal year runs July 1st through June 30th, so that's...
You got it. The chart before is sort of not as clear as it could be.
I got it.
I think we ought to put the year basis on mm-hmm. there.
I got you.
I'm clear. Thank you.
Yeah, it's probably, I'm so used to fiscal year and knowing what our fiscal year is that... I don't always realize that everyone else does.
I didn't make the change in my brain from my work last night to my work this morning.
Just a quick comment. Steve, thank you for the presentation. And one thing I'd like to note, as Steve mentioned, we did have an accumulating cash balance due to a number of some grant agreements that were being sort of held up for various reasons. And I've been working with staff for the last few days, and we're going to be working together very hard over the next few weeks to, we recognize that if the funds are sitting in our balances, it's not actually getting to our grantees and then also essentially getting to the customers and transit users across the state. So we're very committed to seeking a faster resolution to a lot of these issues so that we don't have these accumulating cash balances in the future. We're also going to be working, again, as Steve mentioned, on our projections for cash flow, especially on capital projects, to make sure that in the future our annual budgets are very reflective of what we think our expenditures will be. And as Steve mentioned as well, I wanted to thank the CTB for the approval of the working capital balance as well at the previous meeting. I think it's going to be very important to DRPT to be able to have that in place as part of sound financial policies and procedures.
Thank you for that comment. Have we resolved the administrative issues in Northern Virginia in terms of getting the funds that we discussed?
There's a few that we still have to work out, but I think, you know, both we recognize and the grantees recognize that they're, you know, with a little bit more concerted effort and discussions that they can be worked out pretty quickly. So I think we see a path forward on several of these, and I think they'll be resolved very soon.
Well, I would encourage us to do so, obviously, fiduciary responsibility-wise, but as you pointed out, if once we decide a project, we want the project going forward. So sitting in our accounts, that means nothing's happening. Mm-hmm. And so I don't think that's a good steward. So let's try to push those out. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions for Mr. Pitter? Okay, thank you. See, I think next we have Mr. Lawson.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
Good morning.
While since I've been here with you for one reason or another. Is it on here, Carol? That's a 6-year improvement.
It shouldn't say that. We just have to
watch it. Okay. You're right. Never doubt, Carol. This morning, I wanted to give you a little overview of where we are through the first half of the fiscal year. In your package, you received the reports through November. As Steve mentioned, we had a very, very quick turnaround this month, and I do have December information to provide to you today. In terms of revenue, the Commonwealth Transportation Fund is reporting annual growth of about 14.4%. Compared to the forecast, which is about 1.2% above the forecasted growth rate. Our federal program, our federal revenues, obviously are tied to our construction and maintenance activities, and with the strength of those programs, our federal revenues continue to remain strong. In terms of spending this year, we were a little aggressive in our spending plans and are running slightly behind forecast, but as you'll see, toward the end of the presentation, we are very close. And we have in this report, you'll note that the state revenue forecast has been revised from the previous report. I'll speak more to that in just a moment. As I've stated, you know, the CTF revenues are doing a little better than expected. The forecast was revised by the Department of Taxation in December. That is part of the annual governor's budget process, and they update the forecast every year, and later in the workshop I'll speak more to the changes in that forecast. In terms of motor vehicle sales and use taxes, they continue to be strong. We're looking at growth about 40% higher in December of 13 compared to December of 12. Our year-to-date growth rate is just shy of 33%. And as part of the revenue forecast adjustment, the forecast has actually increased from about 34% to 38%. The state sales and use tax revenues have also grown by over 56%, and largely due to the new revenues provided by House Bill 2313. Running slightly below the forecasted growth rate of 60.8%, but that number is also an adjustment from the growth rate that was in the previous forecast.
Mr. Lawson, later in your presentation, will you talk about why it's behind forecast? Or do you address that later?
Well, I will speak to that some little later. Yes,
okay,
sir.
Okay, thank you.
In terms of just the overall performance, this gives you the numerical comparison for each of the major revenue sources. And again, you can see how we are comparing year over year, as well as the change in each source as it compares to the forecasted growth rate. And again, the forecasted growth rates now presented to you are based off of the December forecast. I mentioned earlier, federal revenues are remaining strong, and you can see here that the growth in the federal revenue and the strength of the federal revenue it is largely being driven by activities within the construction program. Maintenance and the ARRA programs are both down some from last year, but that was anticipated based on the fact that the ARRA program is kind of dwindling and nearing the end of its completion. And we had just some different, the whole maintenance budget was a bit different this year than last, so that this is not unexpected. This is just a graphical illustration in terms of total spending. We spent $2.3 billion year to date, which is only $17 million less than where we were through the first half of 2013. You can see the maintenance, the construction spending on the top comparison is slightly ahead of where we were last year, and maintenance spending is a little less. Speaking of spending at the program level, in terms of maintenance, we spent $134 million in December. Year to date, about $860 million. We are about $95 million behind where we were this time last year. But if you note, that the budget this year is about nearly $100 million less than it was last year. And that is due to the fact that the carryover, the unspent amount from fiscal year 12 was much greater than the carryover from fiscal 13. In looking at where we expect to go, we're expecting to spend just shy of $1.6 billion this year, leaving somewhere in the neighborhood of $70 million or less remaining in unspent allocations. Last year, and just a reminder, we did finish the year at about a $98 million unspent balance, and our goal is to keep that balance less than $100 million. On the construction... Yes, sir.
I'm not. Are you saying to spend less than budget in maintenance is good?
Well, you can't spend more.
I understand that, but the question is, what have we not done that we said we were going to?
Well, it's part of our spending plan, and you have to remember you're taking $100 million roughly from the year before and spending it this year, and then basically leaving $100 million going forward. That $100 million is committed. It's committed work, so it's not that we haven't done something. It's just all about timing and sequencing and being able to address the unknowns of natural disasters and so forth that may occur during the year. You can't tie yourself too tight because statutorily we can't exceed that budget amount.
Mr. Chairman?
Hello.
Ms. Lawson, can you remind us where we were 3 years ago on unspent balances at the end of the year?
Big number.
We were at one time, it was about $450 million.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we were beaten on that for, I know I was amongst others.
Absolutely.
We've been beaten on that to get that number down. Now, when you show us these numbers on this maintenance program page, for example, is that the total new revenue or is that the spending plan?
The allocations you see here are the total funds available to the program.
Okay, so.
And then there's a slide later.
Back to some points I've made earlier a year or so ago. There's a difference between the money that's allocated to us and what our spending plan is, if you will. Because just because the money's allocated does not mean we have the time to program it and spend it. Can't spend it before you get it. So there is a natural lag in this process. Now we're down to 70 or 80 million bucks. We were at 450 million bucks. And probably 70, would you agree with me that 70 or 80 or 90 million bucks is probably about as good as it's going to get?
It is, well.
On a continuing basis.
On a continuing basis.
I think
you'll see that under the new chief engineer, Garrett Moore, he is really pushing that and trying to bring it down, but bring it down in a very responsible way. Yes,
so in essence, in another board I'm on, we look at two sets of numbers. We look at really what's allocated to us, and then we look at our spending plan. And we sort of decide that at the beginning of the year, of course. And if we're meeting our spending plan, then we're happy.
Right.
Because some of these projects that get allocated to us may flop over a fiscal year. They may take a year or more to happen. So you're going to have a natural sort of backlog, if you will, of funds. It was unreasonable before. Now I think it's fairly reasonable. If you got it down to $70 million what's the total yearly?
1.6.
1.6. Yeah. So you're talking, 5%, 4%.
And as you can see here on the very bottom of the slide, I just want to point out that as of December, we are about $20 million behind the spend plan.
Right, and that's the number that I like to focus on.
And there's a later slide that shows the total picture as we move forward.
Mr. Lawson, I'd like, Mr. Kilpatrick, to Mr. Whitworth's question here, maybe in terms of the carry forward and stuff.
And John, maybe you can talk just very briefly in terms of the allocation, the combination of what's allocated in that fiscal year and the balance carried forward. And the message here is that, again, about 3 years ago, we were carrying somewhere in the order of $400+ million forward into the next fiscal year. So it was the allocation that was available plus what came forward. We've worked very aggressively to reduce that carry forward. And if you look in terms of expenditures to date, we're about halfway through the year, and we've expended about half of our allocated funds. Again, John was just mentioning, we're really down to about $19.7 million behind schedule. And a lot of things are involved there, including winter operations. We've been fortunate to date there. So, John, I don't know if you have anything else to mention about that. And hopefully that gives a better picture about the delta, the difference in the total cost, the total allocation.
Right. So as a catch up, when we're had sort of gotten caught up, we got that one time hit of pushing it forward. Although we've increased the outlay, VDOT's annual outlay is almost $2.5 billion from $1.5 billion from where we were a couple of years ago.
Yes, sir. In terms of and we reported last month that we were moving. We're having a very good year in terms of contract value or project value, in terms of project value going out the door. And we reported out end of year over $2.6 billion worth of project value that went out the door in terms of advertisements, engineering and construction advertisements. That's not those are in process. I don't have the exact numbers, but it's significantly higher than any year previous.
And it appears, just for our industry friends and our utility people that we deal with, that's going to be a sustained type of effort because of the new House bill transportation revenues. So in terms of utility relocations and what have you, we've had preliminary meetings of letting them have foresight as to what's coming to gear up to handle, because we've had record closures across the state. So besides the catch-up, physically moving some of this stuff because of inherent issues and moving it forward, we're trying to address in that regard too.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Cole.
Mr. Lawson, of the total $1.6 billion in the maintenance budget, what percentage would you estimate is good to have not spent? That's a positive. In other words, snow removal. If we don't spend it, that's good. There's probably some sign maintenance that we anticipate every year. Some we need, some we don't. Is that a big enough percentage to even think about?
Not really, but I will say that we come spring. We very carefully look at what, like the snow operation, for example. If there are snow funds left because we had a good winter. We work diligently to put those to work for beneficial reasons, instead of just letting the balances set and roll over to the next year. We look to that something less than $100 million balance to remain, just without looking at any particular area in which it should be in. You know, and just pointing to the commission, back to the commissioner's comment, the $1.622 billion budget that we're showing for the maintenance program this year does include the $98 million that carried over from last year. So, again, it's assuming we leave no more than $98 million on the table, or something on the table, but unspent, we'll have expended our full annual allocation. So it's just kind of that, call it a safety net almost, that is keeping us going from year to year, that we just can't push it too far to the bottom.
Secretary.
Service
also, there's another corollary to just the numbers, though, and that is the adequacy of the maintenance throughout the system that we have to keep an eye on as well. So even though we're spending the dollars and we like where that's going on, we still have to see, you know, what percentage of the secondary system is inadequate right now, has to be improved, and I know that'll be a challenge for Charlie. So don't forget it. We can't forget about that side.
I mentioned earlier the construction program. Again, it's slightly above spending compared to this time last year. We talked about a lot of projects going on the street, but we have to remember it takes time for a lot of this work to get started. So I expect the numbers to grow, but even faster as we move forward. From a forecasted spending perspective, we are about $12 million below forecast. So again. Pretty close to where we thought we would be. This is the slide that takes that look at anticipated spending versus the budget, and you can see here that our current operating budget is about $4.8 billion, and you can see that our planned spending is about 4.9 when we include in the adjustments that we have brought forward. And you can see forecasted spending to date compared to actual spending. And if you look at across all programs, we're within $33 million of where we thought we would be at this point through the year.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lawson, can you speak to the construction funding line and the change of about 240 some million dollars from the original forecast to the current forecast?
Yeah, yes.
Looking at columns 2 and 3. Yeah.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Miller.
And then, you know, there's looks like there's some bond finance versus construction funding, but what's going on with those numbers?
It's a combination of two things, as you noted there. We have increased the planned spending from the bond funding. So again, we have some projects that are funded with both state dollars.
Are there trade-offs?
They're
trade-offs.
And
so
then
functionally, you moved 125 from construction funding to bond funding.
And then we had other projects in terms of schedules and estimates, or just their when they're going in the forecasting scheme, that when we updated their forecast, pushed them out a little bit. So it's the combination of things.
But when you're still about $150 million behind
the original
forecast in that category.
That's correct.
And that's because of some stuff that was pushed out.
Schedule changes, yes, sir. In terms of cash, you can see that the cash balance has changed increased by about $170 million since the beginning of the fiscal year. The majority of those increases are in two places. You see, notice that the Priority Transportation Fund balance has gone up significantly. That is a product of the cycle of paying debt service, so it grows through the year and then gets paid and then grows and gets paid. And then in terms of the Garvey bonds that were issued earlier this year, you see the increase there. I want to take a minute and just speak to the regional funds. Because the regional funds are state revenues, they do flow through the Commonwealth and VDOT's books. So we do show the revenue and related expenditures of those funds. In terms of the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, the forecast for their collections this year is just above $260 million. Through the first half of the year, the forecast was about $1.117 billion, and as you can see, we're slightly above that in terms of collections. The expenditures for the NVTA funds are nothing more than the transfer of the funds to the NVTA. They hold and manage the funds, and they're transferred from the NVTA Commonwealth account to NVTA about middle of every month. So the remaining balance is just the amounts collected that have yet to be transferred. In terms of the Hampton Roads Transportation Fund, you can see their annual forecast of about $180 million. Forecast expected for this point, year to date, about $60 million, and the collections are about $60 million. We are holding those funds in the Hampton Roads Transportation Fund in the Commonwealth, and we'll continue to work with the Hampton Roads region, the TPO, and the use and the disbursement of those funds. To date, there have been no expenditure. That completes my overview. Take any questions that you may have.
Mr. Cole.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Ms. Lawton, do we do any what-if planning to consider changes in federal transportation packages or law? I mean, there are a couple of pieces of legislation in Congress right now that address increases in motor fuels tax and whatnot. And while most people, I think, would not give them a great chance of passing, there seems to be a very positive drumbeat coming from the Governor's Association, Mayor's Association, everyone else, suggesting now is the right time, I think, including the former Secretary of Transportation, LaHood, has also suggested that now's the time. Do we ever take a look at what's out there as a possibility and say, how does that change what we're looking at?
Yes, absolutely. As I explained when we approved this year's budget, we did not build in any growth in the federal revenue because we just didn't anticipate that it would grow. But we, at the same time, didn't build in reductions. But what we do is we continue to monitor where the directions are going, and just like we did last year when we were working through House Bill 2313 and trying to get it passed, we will also look at the different varieties and versions of where the federal transportation plan is going, and we'll do those scenarios to say, okay, if this happens, then this is what it looks like. So we do those periodically as changing times seem to warrant.
And do you see that process ever changing the business decisions that are made today based on what might occur in a year from now?
I don't. I think we are, Mr. Secretary, you can certainly correct me if you believe, but we are stewards of the monies that are coming to us, and we have to move forward to try to utilize those funds the best we can.
What really impacts us if we think they're going down.
Sure.
Yeah, and more so than going up. And of course, I think there's an agenda item later where we're talking about the 6-year plan, and that's where it really impacts projects. What this analysis is sort of where we've been. In terms of spending, the 6-year plan is where we're going, and that's where, Mr. Cole, a lot of that what-if projection would show up, and we're going to talk about that a little later. First of all, if there's any other questions of Mr. Well, a couple things I wanted to mention. We are running slightly behind the projection on motor fuel tax sales, and I assume that has to do with the level of gasoline. In terms of it being the lower pricing. So we're really ahead of last year, but not to our projections. And in fact, if you remember House Bill, the new revenues, there was a floor, and I believe we're at that floor. So thankfully it was in, because prices have decreased, and we're at the floor in that regard. The second thing I'd point out, you show the difference where Northern Virginia and Hampton Roads in terms of how the monies were accounted for the regional funds. The Hampton Roads is on our books. They truly are on VDOT's books. I think there'll be some legislative look at that as to we move them. I get a little cautious whenever anything's on the state's books that people seem to think that there may be. They are Hampton Roads monies, but I think moving them off to a off the books would be appropriate thing to do. So I think there'll be some legislation just for board members that are coming forward in that regard. Mr. Lauterbach.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick comment. I've listened to the presentation of former Secretary LaHood the other night, and he was talking about we need to increase money coming into transportation fund, and his solution was to raise the sales tax or the tax on gas. And it's kind of ironic. It shows a lack of business sense in a way to me that you're starting to see a downslide because of more fuel-efficient cars, less utilization of gasoline because of people not working, whatever the situation might be. So your normal, the reaction is automatically, well, we're going to raise the gas tax and that'll solve the problem, which is going to only cause it to spiral down more. Point being is I think that if you're going to address future funding needs for transportation, there needs to be a better formula for how you're going to accomplish that. And I mean, right now, we seem to go to the simple, put a tax on gas and that's going to solve it. It doesn't when you have a larger fleet or an increasing fleet of cars that are more fuel efficient and ones that are using alternative fuels. So it's just a point of observation. I think we have to be very careful in how we anticipate revenues coming in and relying too heavily on some of those figures.
Any other comments? Questions? Ms. Lawson, thank you. All right, Mr. Brule, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, good morning. I'm going to give you an update on our Economic Development Access Program today. For those who may not be familiar, our Economic Development Access Program is established by state code. It's state-funded with the intent to provide either new or improved access to qualifying economic sites, industrial parks, commerce parks, projects like that. We really have two different ways a locality can pursue funding under the program. First being the traditional path. A locality has a named industry, named business that comes to their locality, has a site in mind, and needs access to the nearest public roadway. We would work with that locality, bring those allocations to you. They would just need to document before we brought that action to the board that the site and the capital investment associated with the site would be five times the cost of the allocation or five times the amount of allocation. The second type of project is our bonded projects. These are much more speculative. These are where localities are seeking industry to come to their community. They're willing to take a little bit of a risk, come to us with a project, and they provide us with surety so that we can get that funding back if they're not able to receive that type of qualifying investment and it's not established within 5 years. The way the program is structured for the bonded projects, it requires the locality to pay back the amount of allocation if there's not a total or partial demonstration of that investment within 5 years. If they do pay us back, a locality can come back and seek a 50% reimbursement from the state if they do have qualifying investment within two subsequent years. Back in 2010, the board recognized that the economic downturn had impacted the ability of localities to attract these type of businesses to their community, and in April of 2010, extended the bonded period for the projects that were scheduled to expire or have us call in the funding or recall the funding between 2010 and July of 2012. We came back to you in June of 2012 and extended that bond moratorium for an additional 2 years, again recognizing that the climate wasn't such that localities were able to attract qualifying businesses to these sites. The next slide gives you about a 20-year history of our bonded program, or actually of the whole Economic Development Access Program. The green part of the bars shows the bonded project. Dark green being totally bonded, lighter green being partially bonded, and it shows that the trend of having these speculative, very speculative bonded projects has gone down significantly since the economy has struggled really since about 2007. The only outlier in there is in 2011, we did have one bonded project that was in Chesterfield County. They had an industry in mind and were able to come to us fairly quickly and release that bond. So we really have not seen this type of very speculative project for quite some time now. The next slide, the first column on this slide, the projects that are in the first column represent those projects that benefited from the initial bond moratorium that was from July 2010 to July 2012. There were eight projects on there. Of those, all of them have been cleared except for three. That's Halifax, King William, and Botetourt. They're indicated with the asterisk. The second column, when we made the extension in 2012, we did pick up seven more projects that fell under that bond moratorium. Of those, six of them are still benefiting from the bond moratorium in that they have not been able to attract a qualifying industry. The third column shows what additional projects we would pick up if we were to extend the bond moratorium for an additional 2 years, seven projects. And just in summary, if we were to allow the current moratorium to expire, we would be in a position where we would have to go back to local government on nine projects and request reimbursement or pull bonds totaling about $3.4 million if they are unable to justify that investment. If we extend the current moratorium by 2 years, it would allow those nine projects additional time to establish investment. Those localities are actively working to draw that investment to be able to clear those projects. And it would also allow those seven additional projects additional time. The expenditures and allocations on those projects is a little over $4 million. So it's our plan to bring to you next month in February a request to extend the bond moratorium for 2 years. Be happy to answer any questions.
Sure. Where are the dollars involved in this extension, Mr. Brewer?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Miller, it's a $5.5 million allocation per year. So it's not a very, very large program, and as you see our trend, we don't bring that many projects to the board. The maximum allocation we can give to a single project under the Economic Development Access Program is $650,000.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Bradley.
I'm not sure I completely understand the program.
Okay.
So we may be getting off the charter waters here. Real quick. So we've got a $5 million cap, and if we extend the moratorium, that ties up what capacity we have under the program for an additional amount of time. Is that true?
Theoretically, but if you look back at slide four, where I showed the requests that we've received, we have a number of years where we have not received a lot of requests. So that fund, the Economic Development Access Fund, has been able to build up allocations. So we don't foresee, we haven't had an experience over the past 4 years with the moratorium where we've had to turn anybody down because we didn't have funding.
And are these on existing, so somebody's brought an economic development prospect in, we've granted the bonding authority out of this program, and they've been unable to pay it back. Is that what we're dealing with here?
No, sir. There's two types of projects. There's a type of project where a locality could come to us and they know a certain industry is coming, they're able to name it, they're able to document the capital investment that's coming to
right.
the locality. In that case, there's
traditional.
There's no bond. If you have a locality, and I'll use one from your district as an example, Botetourt County requested funding in 2006 for the Botetourt Center at Greenfield Phase 2. What they did is they came in, it was a speculative project, they asked us for money to help build the extension of the roadway into that park. And what they have to do is they have to provide us surety or a bond to say if the county doesn't provide us reimbursement for their expenditures, that we can then pull that bond and get our funding back if we have to.
Right.
So it's not, it's a surety, it's an instrument. And what we've done in the case of Botetourt is each time that's been extended, they've had to give us a bond that covers that additional period of time.
I understand. So what we're doing is allowing them additional time to pay back the money we loaned them in order to
correct
in order to build that park. And I understand we've been doing this during this downturn. I think we need to be careful about just routinely extending this program. At some point, times are tough all over, and as long as we're not utilizing, I don't have any problem with this because apparently we've got excess capacity. But things start heating back up, we're not going to have excess capacity. And to the extent we do these moratoriums, it sounds like we're going to be tying up this money for new projects based on other projects that might not be working out. Would that be fair?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Pralin, most of these projects, in fact, the vast majority of the projects were all approved before the economy really took the downturn. So the localities took the risk, really not foreseeing what was going to happen. Localities aren't willing to take that risk on in the current climate.
We're just being a very understanding bank.
We're being a very understanding partner, and I know that these localities are working very aggressively to try to attract that business. They want the business to come to their locality, so they're aggressively working to try to bring that into their locality.
Just so that folks understand the program, this is a grant program, not a loan program. So we are giving monies to these localities to deliver these projects. The payback would only occur if the industry doesn't come. So in the cases here, we have already identified the funding source for these projects, so it's not going to hamper future projects. That we, in general terms, we would not expect a locality to ever pay us money back for building these roadways if the qualifying industry came. So again, I want to make sure folks, it does get a bit confusing in this payback, but the payback only occurs if the industry does not come. Otherwise, it is in fact a grant program.
Mr. Chairman,
if I might just follow up with Charlie, I understand that, but if the industry may never come, and you know, there's risk involved, and that's why you have to have the bond, I assume.
Yes.
So,
Ms. Fisher.
Just to clarify, these are old existing projects. Nothing has been requested or started for a number of years, except for that one project in 2011. Correct. So if you come back to us 2 years from now to say we need another extension of the moratorium, there won't be a whole new batch of projects because there aren't any in the pipeline beyond this?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Fisher, there aren't any more in the pipeline. As you saw from that trend in the chart, we haven't had bonded projects. We've had a couple that we brought to you. We brought one last fall in Bland County that we brought to you as a bonded project. In that case, we knew the locality had a named industry. The locality, most importantly, knew they had a named industry that was committed. And by the time they signed the project agreement, they had that commitment. They had the demonstration of capital investment. So when we bring those to you now, most of the time we know behind the scenes that's all worked out. It's just a matter of they need to get the money going to get the road construction underway, but the commitment is there. But the risk is on the locality in doing that. But typically, the localities are really risk adverse right now to have to pay back money if they don't have that certainty that that industry is coming.
But my point is, this is the last of the flow. So we're not going to be looking at this 2 years from now and seeing more projects that would be at risk that we're going to cut off if we decide not to extend the moratorium.
Correct. This latest extension will pick up the projects that were approved in those last few years that we had bonded request.
Cole first.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Brewer, let me ask Mr. Fralin's question a little. I'm not sure I understood the answer. Do we have $5.5 million in commitment capacity per year or total of $5.5 million in?
$5.5 million per year for the access program. So that's going to be economic development, airport, and rail that are in one fund together. But that each year we have that infusion, and so that fund has built up because we have had very few requests over the last few years.
Thank you, Mr.
Burrell, the seven additional projects that would benefit from this extension, are they traditional or bonded projects?
Everything that would benefit from the extension would be a bonded project. The traditional projects demonstrate their return on investment at the very beginning, and they don't have to provide a bond.
And what would be the ramifications then to those seven projects if we would not extend it?
If we would not extend it, we would be in a position that at the end, when we reach 5 years from their original allocation, if they do not have documentation of that return on investment, then we would have to ask the locality to repay the allocation to the board, or we would call their bond.
And the total of these seven is how much?
It's $4.3 million. Again, these are small projects, but for those localities, it's a significant amount.
And that right now, are they in their second year? What year, you say at the end of 5 years, are they have 5 years from now, or?
No, they have 5 years from their initial allocation. So these seven would come up, their bonded period would expire between July 1st of 2014 and July 1st of 2016. That's where they would be picked up. So they were originally allocated in.
This time?
Are there any projects you're not recommending for extension or you're not seeking approval for?
No, ma'am. Everything that would be eligible under the moratorium is listed.
I would make, oh, Secretary, it's Brent.
I think it's a really, really good program, and I think we should continue to be the understanding bank and give these localities additional time.
I just make the comment that many of these localities, you know, this would be a significant amount to pay back, and you know, some of these projects, if they had to, and you know, some are not in the most economically great areas, and so just think we should consider that, particularly when we're looking at economic development going forward, that causing these other greater hardships, just want to consider in our decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Before we have, it looks like before we have our next presentation, we have a new member with us today. John Malbin joins us as the Hampton Roads representative on the Commonwealth Transportation Board. So, John, welcome. And if you take a minute or so and just introduce yourself to the group, please.
I'm John Malbin. I live in Virginia Beach. I'm taking Aubrey's spot, which is big shoes to follow, but I'll work hard and see what I can do. But my business is I'm a Pastor Oil Company. I'm petroleum marketing in the region. So.
Well, we look forward to you joining the board. I'm sure you're up to speed on everything already. You've been here 5 minutes. I can assure you Mr. Miller or someone else will be happy to show you how that goes in that. But we welcome you here and look forward to you serving with us.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Miller.
Have you talked to Mr. Malbin about the initiation process?
I have not talked to Mr. Malbin, so
no, I guess. The chef first.
Yeah. I suppose that includes his wallet, Mr. Miller.
I'd like to add my congratulations to Mr. Malbin. He's well known in our community in Virginia Beach, particularly. He's been very involved in our community there. I was telling Mr. Lane, or Secretary Lane, this morning, it's sort of a funny scenario because I was on the way up here talking to him on the phone. And as we sit here, Mr. Lane's wife and my wife are in Mr. Malbin's office working on a charitable venture. So we're all in here trying to do our best for our communities and our Commonwealth. And I welcome you, sir, and look forward to working with you.
I suppose we're lucky Mr. Malvin's not in the office, too. Anyway, welcome. Appreciate your willing to serve the Commonwealth. Okay, we'll move now. We have an update from Mr. Lawson. You're back up again. Ms. Busher?
Good morning again. As I mentioned earlier, we have a new revenue forecast that was released in December by the taxation, and we have now taken a look at what the impacts of those that forecasted update is for 14 through 19, and a look ahead now to 15 through 20 as we begin the six-year program process. Annually, as I mentioned earlier, we get a forecast, revenue forecast update from taxation in December to support our submission for the governor's budget. At the same time, we also revise our federal revenue update, a revenue forecast. When looking at the all major state sources across the 6 years, 14 through 19, We are experiencing a reduction of just shy of $800 million. And to put that in context, it reduces the total from about $2.3 billion to $19.5 billion. In terms of federal revenue, based on the receipt of 2014 actual apportionments and obligation authority through today, we have factored in what we believe to be the federal revenue forecast going forward, and over this same period have adjusted it downward by $123 million. And again, that's from $5.6 billion to $5.5 billion. In all other categories, we have some minor ups and downs with a net total adjustment of $11 million. And you look at where that total $907 million in reductions falls, it's about $68 million related to transit and rail. About $690 million will impact the highway construction program. $178 million in reductions related to the regional revenues. And then an addition of about $31 million due to a host of other smaller categories. In terms of the revenues, where the adjustments are actually taking place, the largest single adjustment, as the chairman alluded to earlier, is related to the sales tax on motor fuels. So across the 6 years, there's a reduction of about $750 million. And again, as was mentioned, the revenue forecast, when it was built a year ago nearly, as we were getting into the process of House Bill 2313, gas prices were much higher than they are today, and the outlook was for those prices to continue to rise. But in the wisdom of the General Assembly, they did put a floor in the legislation that actually held the minimum tax or the minimum price of fuel that is used in the computation of the rate to February the 20th of 2013. If y'all remember, that was about the date in which we hit a high point in gas prices. In the tax forecast looking out now over this period, they are now not anticipating the price of gas to rise above that floor. So that is the big change you're seeing here.
So just to make sure I understand, that is, we have the most conservative forecast that we can have because we've assumed the minimum amount. So any uptick would be positive in gas, or economic activity, gas prices, or what have you.
Absolutely. Okay. Obviously, it's still based off of consumption, but growth in consumption would obviously push it up, as well as if the price of fuel were to rise, it will then in turn push it up.
Mr. Peake?
Yeah. What is the floor that is set by the General Assembly?
In code, it actually says it's the average retail price of fuel as of February the 20th.
What was that?
It was approximately $3.12.
Right.
And again, that's wholesale price.
Yeah.
But the $3.11 was a pre-taxed.
That's the wholesale.
So that was not the retail.
Not retail.
Plus the tax.
Yeah.
Retail was in the $3.60
right,
something range at that time.
That's
$3.11 wholesale price.
Yes, sir. Mr. Fallon, you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peake asked one of my questions, but not the other one. So, who's the Department of Planning budget?
Does
that make the forecast?
It's Department of Taxation.
Department of Taxation. So Department of Taxation is saying that in their estimation for 6 years, the price is going to remain below $3.60 a gallon of gas?
They don't see the wholesale price rising back to that point. Because you look at the wholesale price today.
How in the world can anybody know that?
Well,
that's why I pointed it out.
These are economists, you know, and this is the role of economists.
As an economist overall.
They don't.
And they
want to be, well, you're economist on this case, but no, that's why I wanted to point out it's a fairly conservative view. view of where we're headed.
Worst case.
And I will point out, though, Mr. Freeland, that Department of Taxation, they base their forecast off of a forecast that is produced by the energy producers. It's a very formal representative. You probably know, Mr. Cole, the name of it. I'm escaping me at the moment, but it's a global forecast that is done for energy production and usage that is the kind of the kingpin of that forecast.
Well, I understand and recognize it's a very difficult task to do. What I think the concern may be is what that's going to will that force us to build a very conservative 6-year plan? Because we've got to look out 6 years in terms of construction dollars and getting projects funded and things like that. Whereas if you took some sort of median to use it, you could probably plan a little bit better.
Just
inflation in general is going to have an impact.
Ms. Buescher is going to get into the plan. Without stealing her thunder, I don't think it's going to impact where we are now, but in the future it will, and we'll come back to that if you
hold
on that, Mr. Freeland.
Stand down until
Mr. Cole, and then come to you, Mr. Lauerbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to echo, I think historically we would think of this as being a very conservative plan, but I think Mr. Malcolm would probably agree that with shale oil and the production of shale oil, it's projected by 2016 will be the largest oil producer in the world. The country will be, and will export zero come 2020. That's just about 6 years out. That's all about supply and demand. So I think there are a lot of reasons to suggest this isn't as conservative as we might think it is. We'll be importing 0% of our refined crude oil.
When was the last time that happened?
Mr. Cole? Mr. Malcolm's a lot older than me. He probably
There's a commodity market in Chicago. You can make that bet.
All right. Lost.
Okay.
Mr. Lauterbach had a question.
I'm sorry.
We referred back to the floor on the sales tax, I guess, is it on fuel? Wasn't that floor lower than what we were collecting before because of going to the wholesale collection method, and moving it to a percentage? Wasn't that 12 cents compared to 17 cents that we were collecting at the time? So, therefore, we started out down, and now we're not expecting to really get above where we were before for several years. Is that an accurate assessment?
That is accurate. The objective of one of the objectives of House Bill 2313 was to kind of move the dependency of revenue away from motor fuels and to place it more on retail sales. So that's the reason retail sales was increased by 0.3% at the same time, and the two actions together were seen as normalizing in the first year.
Yeah, the intent of it is that it would be revenue neutral the first year, as you recall.
Right.
And therefore, it was. But now that we've dropped down, it's actually less revenue from where it was.
Well, in addition, In addition, we were also kind of waging or hoping for the internet sales tax,
right,
which is not coming about. And so now that's going to have to go to the sales tax aspect
That's always been in our projection, Mr. I mean, we have always assumed the least amount of revenue from that. It will impact DRPT because some of those revenues, they cannot be used. But in terms of us, we've always assumed the least. Well, we're effective. We've already assumed the least case for both projections. We've not assumed we'd get the Market Equity Act. So that would be a bonus. It appears from here a pickup in activity, Marketplace Equity Act passing would be an increase to our plan. It's like, we've got a fairly conservative plan based on the projections we've been given.
Do you have a projection of what demand will be in the out years?
I don't have them at my ready presence, but we do have that as We have the details from the Department of Taxation and can certainly get you that information where they have the volume data as that goes along with it.
The reason I ask that, I'm assuming that gasoline demand is flat. And the projections for significant growth may be a challenge, particularly with the CAFE standards. And so if you're projecting, I'd be curious what you're forecasting growth to be and make sure that that may not be a, that's not an issue as well.
Okay, I'll be glad to share that with you. There's also some adjustments in the retail sales and use. You see that has been brought down by about $250 million across the 6 years. On the flip side, the motor vehicle sales continue to be strong, and the revenues associated with the car sales has been increased by $161 million, and the rental the revenues from the license fees have also gone up accordingly. And in terms of federal revenue, I just wanted to point that out that the majority of that $120 million is related to the NHPP program, about $70 million. And the two programs, RSTP and CMAC, that are funds distributed to the localities or to the regions, also took some very small reductions. We've been talking a bit about House Bill 2313, and it's very important that we don't lose sight of the benefits that House Bill 2313 have provided and where we would be without it. So for comparison purposes, I'm showing the revenues that were forecasted in their preliminary plan this time last year when we were looking at 14 through 19. We were expecting total revenues in the financial plan of about $25.6 billion. With the passage of 2313, you can see that the state revenues went up by about $4 billion, and the program with all the other pieces that go along with it increased to $33 billion. With these reductions, you can see that the state revenues have gone down, and with a total plan value of $32.3 billion, but still far greater than the 25.6 that we were looking at before the 2313 was enacted.
And the point here is it's over 6 years. I mean, so it's, back in 2008, we were taking this type of hit over each year from the plan, from WIFRAC. So this looks like a pretty much of a base case, but it's substantially better than where we were a year ago. So
now I want to shift to the update, the 2015 through 2020 plan. Again, it's based on the new revenues that I've been talking about. We are projecting the 2015 to 2020 plan to be $32.3 billion. That does incorporate the $491 million reduction from the revenues we just talked about. If you exclude other items to where you're purely looking at state and federal revenues, the reduction from the 14 to 19 plan over the 15 through 20 plan is $55 million. The biggest change is related to changes in the administration of our bond programs. There's $436 million less bond proceeds in this six-year window than there was in the previous six-year window. And again, that was planned and expected. That's not a loss to the program. This numerically explains what I was talking about. You can see in total the state revenues, program over program, have changed by about $73 million. Federal revenue is down about $127 million. You see with the total revenues are down about $55 million, and you can see by bond program the differences. In taking a preliminary look, and I emphasize preliminary look at what the allocations will be for the 15 through 20 program, you see the distribution of the $33 billion in revenue and the comparisons to the prior six-year program plan. The increase in debt service is just expected and planned based on the bond program that we have underway. If you look at maintenance and operations, the growth there is based on our planned growth using the producer price index, which we've been doing now for a couple years. In terms of other major areas of change, you see rail and public transportation has a reduction of about $93 million. The biggest component of that is related to the bond sales. So again, part of the administration of the bond program. And in terms of the construction, it's almost an $850 million reduction in construction. This is caused by and will cause a couple things I need to point out. First, is related to crossover. Based on the plan a year ago, crossover would have been eliminated in 2017, with the total funding transferred from construction to the Highway Maintenance and Operating Fund of about $450 million. Based on this preliminary plan, crossover will return in all years, and we will transfer about $725 million over the six-year period. As a result of this, we also lose the ability to go past the CTB formula and flow funds through the original 40-30-30 formula. We had anticipated funds that would begin to flow through 40-30-30 in 17, and at this point, throughout the whole period, there's no funds to be distributed through the 40-30-30 with all funds being distributed, the amount under $500 million through the CTB formula. Shift just a moment to federal aid look. And as we spoke a little about earlier, we are not predicting any growth beyond the expiration of MAP 21. We continue to watch what's going on at the congressional level to see where things appear to be going. As we all know, the current level of funding from Federal Highway cannot be sustained based on the revenues that are solely being generated by the Highway Trust Fund. In order to keep at that same level without tax increases would require some significant infusions of general fund to keep it moving. We look forward, I believe there's clear interest and understanding at the federal level that the funding is needed, and we have to support the effort as it moves forward, and I personally believe that they will come step up and do something to protect the revenues.
With that, I'd like Ms. Buescher to come up. She's going to talk now about the plan and potential impact to the capital improvement program.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the CTB. What we'll talk about on the next two, three slides is what our strategy will be to try to deal with the revised revenue estimates. But we feel very fortunate that we have the revenue in place that we do from House Bill 2313 still carrying us forward. We usually start off at this time of year talking about the priorities that we will use for developing the update of the six-year program. And these are the priorities that we've presented to you in the past years. And they're reflected on slide 13. We will always continue to review and fund any deficits on projects underway. We will continue to maximize federal funds to meet federal strategy. And we continue to, we would continue to fund deficient bridges and paving projects to meet performance measures. And we would like to recommend that we continue using 4% of the federal funds for the ADHS program, which is quarter Q, and continue those projects through construction into the out years. And also, as MAP 21 no longer provided a set aside for funding for bridges, we would like to continue at the normal funding level from safety lieu of 13% of the total federal maintenance and construction funds over the 6 years. We would like to continue with that new priority.
Mr. Frame.
Ms. Busher, I think this is a big deal that with these new projections that there's not going to be money flowing through the traditional formula. I think unlike what we originally projected, because that includes some of the municipality allocations and some of the other things that I think are important. And what because I wasn't on the board in 2012 when the CTB formula was created, which I believe is when that happened.
The alternative formula, yes, sir, through the General Assembly in 2012.
And I believe that was created in response to the fact that we weren't going to have any construction money unless we were able to lump it together and sort of direct it better. Given that we've now got some money, I guess it would be up to the General Assembly to look at whether or not the CTB formula versus the traditional formula needs to be in place. Is that right? We're just sort of carrying out the law as it is right now.
Mr. Friend, the code provision allows up to $500 million to be pushed through what we call the CTB formula.
Right.
What we're saying, based on the projections, we will not exceed that $500 million available funds. Once we cascade the available construction funds through the various pieces that get to the discretionary level, we will have less than $500 million through the balance of the six-year plan, through the six-year plan. And so again, that's where
I
we begin.
I'm not really asking a technical question. I'm asking a policy question about the reason that was put in place. Was my understanding was in 2012, the frustration was we weren't able to accumulate enough through the traditional formula to do much construction because we didn't have enough money.
That is
correct.
We got
more money, and we're going to push it through the CTB plan formula that's been created. And I guess my question is, how much more, if we did it the old way, would we be in a situation where we still wouldn't have enough money, or would that policy reason for creating the formula still be existing?
The short answer is yet we would not have sufficient funds to make a realistic impact through the formula. What ends up happening is, as you distribute that through that cascading through both the primary, the secondary, and the urban system, it becomes very, very small dollar amounts. And when it's distributed that way, a locality would need to accumulate sufficient money in that account in order to deliver a project. So in other words, as the piece gets smaller and smaller, and then you have to accumulate before you can build a project. Effectively, what that does is we start to accumulate overall balances of construction funds that we're not able to put towards projects.
I understand. I think from the locality's perspective, of the ability to accumulate, at least they have the ability to accumulate some.
Yes, sir.
And with the CTB formula, they don't.
Sector.
Yes, sir, Mr. President.
I think it's going to be incumbent upon us to make sure that the localities understand that the formula is not now going to go into effect because we had told them 17 was the year. So let's be right up front about that. You know, right, that's the way it's going.
Yeah, that'll be, it's been the subject of a lot of their legislators, and we've been giving them briefings. We've actually showed where the projects in their district actually probably will exceed what they would get on the formula. It may not be the project, you know, specifically that they would have chosen, but it is a project that is deemed of significance by the criteria set out in the formula in that. But I think in the next couple of years anyway, it's just not any money for the, regardless of what we're doing. I mean, in that, if the real issue is that it's even going to be pushed back a few years if these revenue projections are accurate. Now, I guess the only good news I'll say is I don't think they can, I shouldn't say this, but it doesn't appear they can get any worse. And so it's really letting them know that if things pick up, that'll happen sooner. But anyway, yes, Mr. Cole.
Mr. Chairman, if guys seek a favor, when we're using the less frequently heard acronyms and abbreviations, could we kind of at least for a meeting or two spell those out, what they are? I'd say it's for the benefit of our new members, but it's really for me.
I'll second that too. That's right.
I'll send you the Bible of acronyms I had prepared.
Yeah, we do have a glossary. So
I'll
we'll get
that
out
again. I had that problem about 3 years ago, and they finally put together something, so it's quite helpful.
So back to the slide. These are still the priorities we would recommend. And we would ask if there were any changes that we address that now. If you're fine with the priorities as they are for which the 14 through 19 program was developed, that would be what we would like to go forward with. Yes, sir. Mr. Sterling.
Yes,
Mr. As we stretched out for that additional week, put in the additional year, what is available there, and I know what you're talking about is sort of stretching this project out or the program out. Is that sufficient to cover the projects that are in there, or are we now still having to go beyond that? Is there additional funds with the new year based on everything? Where does that really put us as we look at the future?
I'm going to go back to slide 11. We will, as John mentioned, continue to program the remaining new state funding through the CTB formula. However, we don't get to the excess of 500, so we won't be going through the state construction formula. Based on the revenue estimates, as John presented them, so we're probably looking at about $700 million for highway construction. What we're proposing to do is stretch or delay project schedules for projects not yet underway. So we'll be looking at all schedules and estimates that currently appear in the program, and then as you know, we have projects beginning in each year of the 6 years. So we'll look first at stretching those project schedules out so that we can stretch the funding to not have to unfund projects that are currently in the 14 through 19 program. But
yes.
To accomplish that and to talk a little bit about what you're speaking about, when we look at the approximate reduction for the highway construction program, not having funding flow through the 40-30-30 is in effect a way of reducing a portion of the program that of the 14 through 19 program that will no longer exist. So that was about $300 million. So what we would look to do to be able to stretch and continue to keep projects programmed is we'll have to use the revenue coming in 2020. Instead of having that revenue potentially available for new projects, if you will, that's what will allow us to move funding on projects out from maybe new something that had a construction start date of 15, move it to 17, move something in 17 out to 20. So we're literally going to be using the new revenue that would be projected to coming into the program, new money to balance the 14-19 loss to carry us through 15 through 20. Without looking at cutting projects.
Based on current estimates, the program of record, not by year but by project, we should still be able to do the program of record although it might just adjust in the years of specific projects.
That is our strategy based on the revenue estimate coming in 2020 and the stop of the flow, nothing happening in the 40-30-30 combined. That will allow us to do some stretching, but part of the key here are the schedules of projects in the six-year program.
And keep in mind, many of them slip not because we want them to slip. They slip because of other things. So in other words, if you look at our natural thing, it doesn't appear to be any significant change. That's why I pointed out we're pretty much at the low level. In other words, you know,
so like if Federal Highways is delaying any projects or things like that, that could affect,
but that would have effect whether we had the money or not. But
right.
those are the projects that we'd say, okay, we've got a few of those already. Yeah. So Mr. Brzezinski had.
But it's a combination of the state and federal money that we'll be looking at to be
right.
able to try to work with the 2020 revenue to help us with that strategy.
We're also, I know it's one of our priorities, to increase funding for preliminary engineering, to have the ability to jumpstart projects if indeed the lowball projections are wrong. So is that more for the like a 30% number on a project for preliminary? Is that what Garrett uses or the district uses?
Mr. Kilpatrick will respond to that.
Sure.
Mr. Krasinski, one of the things that we want to make sure of is that we don't get caught on our heels. That if revenues are better than what we're currently projecting, that we have the, I'll call it the inventory, the covered with projects available to go to advertisement. It is much easier to take a project and hold it from advertisement than to receive a slug of money from whatever source and say, go out and spend it, because it takes a considerable amount of time to do the engineering work, to do the utility work, the right-of-way, all of those steps. So we want to have more projects available to go to construction than we have construction dollars available. Now, you don't want years of plan rolls piling up on the shelf because they do get old, they do get stale. But again, this is what we have tasked the chief engineer, Garrett Moore, and his folks working with programming and working with John on the finance side to make sure that we are on the development side, we're ahead of this curve so that if or when that additional funds become available, we can move forward. We will not be caught on our heels saying, wow, gosh, we got more money, I don't know what to do with it because I don't have the projects. We will have the projects available.
So we in the district should pay particular attention to preliminary engineering dollars
Absolutely.
We will continue as we program, and as you know, we've told you that it really comes down to, in the update, we will look at all schedules and estimates and do some balancing over the years. With 2020 coming on, the need for PE starts, and those things, we will do our best to make that stretch, that money stretch, and get a combination of.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I would sort of piling on to Mr. Braylon's comment, the CTP formula as it's written in the law is not a mandate. It's an allowance. And our former secretary, I think, took the position that it was a mandate because it had been negotiated. In fact, we had some debate about that point here. I don't know what the current...
It's a budget amendment. It's not law. It's what the CTB did in its budget appropriation.
Yeah, we could take this CTB formula and use zero if we wanted to, or we could take up to $500 million and allocate it those ways. But it was not a mandate in the law, but it was, as it was explained, it was negotiated in good faith. So that's sort of where we are as it relates to that.
Right.
I think we ultimately have flexibility, at least by the law we have flexibility.
Yes, it is. It is an appropriation, and to CTB, at the present time, I'm not suggesting we should change, but it should in the future. This board has the authority to change that. Yeah. Let me throw one, make one comment about how this is, comes into play in the real world. I was in a confirmation hearing yesterday, and I was asked about Route 460 in terms of what, and it was from a legislator who did not favor the road. My response was is that one of the things that Governor McAuliffe has made clear is we're going to be good stewards of this money, of the monies going forward. That road, as we all know, is now having an issue with getting its permit. We're working through the permit price. Therefore, what I've asked VDOT is we're just not going to spend any additional monies on construction or on right-of-way until we get the permitting. Now, that's probably going to allow some monies, you know, depending on how it falls, that, you know, that we're able to move around because it won't happen. Not because of any money that we didn't have before, but simply just the way the process works. So that's the real-world application of this. It appears that we've got flexibility in terms of moving these monies around at this, and that's why I wanted to point out it was a very conservative estimate. So I'm comfortable that we're, you know, I don't think we're going to impact our current six-year plan. And so those monies, again, that just happens to be one project. It's a major project. Monies may not be spent this year. We can put on other projects. But we'll still fund that project as we go through our plan process in that.
One of the other things John mentioned in terms of the reduction in the federal estimates, it will impact the CMAQ and RSTP funding, and that equates to about 2.1% in the regional STP funding, or approximately $9.4 million, and 2.3% in CMAQ, or $6.8 million in the program update. And we wanted to bring this out early. This will actually be giving the MPOs their numbers February 5th. We're scheduling a regional meeting, so they have as much time as possible to look at how to balance their programs with a slight reduction.
Are those reductions prorated across the various districts, or are we looking at some districts?
It's based on population.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. One thing we also would like to highlight in the program, and Jennifer DeBrule will talk about this a little bit later, we would like to recommend increasing the revenue sharing allocation for each year of the 15 through 20 program. And this is to meet the needs. She'll speak to the fact we have approximately $184 million in requests for revenue sharing, and this program is dollar for dollar. And I think it's something that's important for cities and counties to be able to use this funding for projects that they have interested in their locality. So that means we will be going from $150 million allocation a year to $184 million allocation a year. And that's approximately a $200 million increase over the 6 years. I included this slide partly for information for new CTB members and partly to reflect the 14 through 19 program was a significant increase in our ability to fund projects. And the reduction that we're looking at in 15 through 19 is only a portion of the significant amount of revenue that we are receiving through House Bill 2313. When you look at the $15.7 billion that we had in 2014 through 19 program, that was a 38% increase. And when you add the Northern Virginia component, that was a 54% increase, or approximately $6 billion over the 13 through 18 program. And the projects we have in the program are good projects all across the state and are making a difference in what we're able to do in the corridors of statewide significance. So I wanted to bring that forward for a moment.
One of the things that I do normally at this time highlight for you all is the tentative schedule at this point for the 2015 through 2020 six-year improvement program update. We've begun in January. We have our new revenues. We'll share that with localities and MPOs and PDCs. One thing that I'll just reflect that's different from last year's, we're scheduled to bring the draft six-year improvement program to the CTB in April. Last year we brought it to you in May, given the fact we had to update the six-year program for changes in funding programs through MAP 21. So we're able to go back to our original schedule of April to bring the draft. That we'll then have public hearings in April and May and bring the final back to you all in June for adoption. Any questions that you might have? Any additional questions?
I don't believe I was paying close enough attention, Rita, but you referred to some reallocation. But I believe you said it was reimbursed or the spread according to population.
The RSTP and CMAQ, the regional STP funding is based on population greater than 200,000, less than, I'm sorry? Oh, the RSTP is just greater than 200,000, you're right, for those MPOs with population greater than 200,000.
That's a regulated number.
Yes.
But we don't get to decide that.
That's my question. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Whitworth?
No. The question I brought up last time, I don't know if it's addressed or not, having to do with the public hearings being held before or after the preliminary draft. What is your expectation on that?
I think at this point we're looking at having the fall meetings in October, November.
I'm talking about the May meeting, the April meetings.
At this time we were not looking to make that.
So tell me again then the input from those public meetings would have what input on the preliminary draft?
The input that we look to receive in the October and November timeframe to be used in the development of the draft is the fall meetings and all nine construction districts. The district administrators and the staff in the construction district communicate with each of the localities, the cities and counties that fall within their construction district for their funding priorities, so their project priorities. We also receive priorities at that time, or at least by January. We're asking for it from MPOs and PDCs for any updates to their project prioritization. All of that is taken into account with regard to our available resources to update the six-year program. So we take into account that to develop the draft. We speak to that, and we have on record at the fall meetings their comments, citizen comments as well.
I understand that.
And then the public hearings between in April and May is for them to comment on how we've taken their suggestions and or the prioritizations of localities and MPOs and PDCs and applied it into the update. This year, as you know, we will be impacted by the reduction. We hope not to reduce any funding on projects. So this year, we would like to keep to the schedule of the public hearing.
So will the public then be aware of what the contents of the preliminary draft at their respective public hearing?
Yes,
that's the whole purpose.
That's
the whole purpose of
so
it.
So the public will see the preliminary draft
right
at the time of their meeting.
They will actually have it in advance of the public meeting, but not by only a week or so.
for you to come back and make any suggestions or advocate for any changes, that is really what these meetings are for.
Right. And will we be then coming back after, at the time we look at the preliminary draft, or will be really at the time we look at the final draft?
You will have between the last ones in May, so you will have at least 30 days before the June meeting when you would look to adopt right.
The final six-year program update. But that doesn't prevent you, after the draft is published at the and provided to you at the April meeting, for you to provide us with your thoughts or comments between then.
I just, my concern is we hear the public, we need to be able to reflect on it before we look at a final draft to be voted on, and need to give feedback to that.
And as a CTB member, that is really, that's right. I mean, that's what our real roles are, is to advocate for those projects and to present them to this board before we make the final decision. Absolutely. That's exactly.
Mr. Secretary, and one of the critiques that we always hear at those meetings, and I read as well aware of this as well, is the understanding of that draft. In other words, how the general public trying to sift their way through that. I wish there was some way we could somehow get a, I would call it an executive summary or the highlights, so that the public is more understanding of the six-year plan, as opposed to going through it and having to follow the districts and the counties. And you know, it's pretty complicated for the general public.
It is. That's what, as a CTB member, I took it upon myself to try to get. Well, I know that's one thing, and I know you have too. The other is the working with the MPO and have them go through the analysis. That doesn't mean that we can't help make it better, but what you brought up, Mr. Worth, was exactly what the key position of this, that this really is for you to get in there and understand and help your citizens understand. That doesn't mean we can't help you in that regard, but that's the whole real focus of this.
Your district administrators will also be looking at the changes in their projects in their district to provide to you their comments or concerns, perhaps, on anything in the draft that's changed that they want to bring to your attention.
Ms. Fisher, and I'll come to Mr.
One thing I'd like to point out that was very useful to us, yesterday Gary and I actually spent the entire day over at the Northern Virginia District Headquarters, because Helen Cuervo, the district administrator, had arranged for each of the major localities to have their transportation staff come in and talk to us and to her staff to talk about what their priorities are before the submission. And looking at it from that perspective and starting at the very beginning and hearing from the localities was very, very helpful to me, and I know it was helpful to Gary as well in understanding where we wind up. So that's a suggestion that a lot of districts might look at.
That's what I did. We did it in our district too. Mr. Miller?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I would also advocate that we, when we come back with the final from the draft, that we make it very clear what the changes are. As you know, in the past, sometimes it's been difficult to focus in on the changes because of the presentation. So I certainly want to be able to see, and I know everybody else wants to see the same thing. Okay, we started with this draft. Don't give me the new plan. Give me the changes.
Having been in your seat, I understand exactly, and that is one thing that we will make sure that it's a little more clear to see.
We provided you, the CTB, at that board meeting, a line-by-line or project-by-project list of all the changes from the draft to the final, and we'll do that again.
Okay, thank you.
Just one good question. Slide 13, just fund the ADHS projects with an average of 4% of total federal maintenance. Is that an arbitrary number, is 4%, or where did that number come from?
That was the equivalent of the amount we had been receiving prior to MAP 21, which was an actual dollar amount set aside out of the federal funds, and it was approximately $32 million a year. That 4% equated to that. With this federal reduction, it'll be slightly less than that. It's our goal to continue to keep the same pace and the project schedules to complete those projects in the program.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Buescher. I think because I mentioned earlier that we're sort of running up against the time for the governor to address us, come here, we're going to suspend right now the workshop. And we're going to take, I would ask about 10 minutes, 10 to 15 minutes to grab a lunch over here. And when we come back, we're going to go into formal session. Where I may move around some of the agenda items there to be able to present the new business item so that we can act upon that before the governor comes. And I think it's also a good time to do that based on the last presentation we've seen so that people, in taking in things in the context of where we are. So we'll suspend that, and let's give us 10 minutes, and we'll be back to grab a quick lunch at 12:20. We'll come back into formal session. We'll start. We will have the action item portion of our Commonwealth Transportation Board meeting begin as of now. The first order of business will be approval of the minutes. I think everyone had been distributed, and if there are no additions or changes or comments, I'd entertain a...
So moved.
Second. Any comments? Any other changes? All those in favor of approval of minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. As I discussed with you before, we're going to change up a little bit in preparation for our meeting with the governor. We will have public comment, but it will be held after the governor speaks. So we will entertain anybody who would like to address us, and I'd hope you would just give us a little leeway as we try to meet the governor's schedule. I'm going to be presenting, and I think it'll be better for me to come up there so I can address the board. So if you'll give me a second, we'll continue the meeting. Well, good afternoon. As all of you know, Governor McAuliffe made a key part of his campaign dealing with the tolls at the Downtown Midtown Project in terms of asking for if there was any way to get relief for the citizens in that area. It's a critically important issue to the citizens of Hampton Roads and especially for those who live in Portsmouth and Norfolk. And so it has been a top priority as I've worked with the governor over the last 30 days during the transition for both of us to see if we could come up with a solution. And he has regularly met with me as secretary to discuss the options. Now, the governor has made it clear that he is in favor of tolls on projects. But those tolls need to be reasonable. And they need to be taken into context with other contributions that we've made in other projects across the state. We have too many large infrastructure projects across the state that if we didn't have tolls, the fact of the matter is they just wouldn't be built. We all know that that revenue source is critical. So they are a good tool to keep in the toolbox. But they can't serve and should not serve to solve every problem that we face. We know we have just asked our citizens also to raise additional monies through, we talked about the sales and use tax on wholesale motor fuels and other things. So in addition to that, we're asking some of our citizens to pay tolls. Now, this project consists of critical improvements that the Hampton Roads area needs. And again, it would not be feasible without some type of tolling on there. But we've all got to make sure, always need to make sure that these tolls make sense. So the governor and I have reviewed several plans, taking into consideration, one, the level of tolling. Two, we have a contract that is a bonding contract with our private partners. And three, that this, and most critically, is the first project in the state of Virginia where we've asked citizens to pay tolls in advance of having the capacity in place for the project. Now, this whole project's been well publicized in the past. We know there's been a lot of publicity regarding the contestant of tolls and whether or not they are appropriate to use. Of course, the Supreme Court has ruled on this matter, and again, we'll need to use them on other projects across not only Hampton Roads, but across the state. And I'll also point out that we do have our citizens paying tolls all across our state, whether it's not just in Hampton Roads. We have them here in Richmond. We have them in Northern Virginia. So with all these factors in mind, and in considering the fact that this project, with a binding contract, we propose the following in an effort to begin addressing these tolling issues. So let me see here, Carol. What do I need to do? Just go up here and tick on...
Click on PDF.
PDF. There we go. So what you see in front of you, the Governor McAuliffe has authorized, with the support of this board, is an effort to mitigate tolls until the new tunnel across the Elizabeth River is in place. The tolls, as you all know, will begin February 1st. So officially, we've had 2 days since taking office to get this plan in place. And I want to reiterate, it does not necessarily mean that this is all that's going to happen, but we wanted to bring immediate relief to our citizens. So beginning on February 1st, tolls will commence, but the initial toll rates will be substantially lower, almost in half of what was originally planned. From February 1st to 2014, December 31st, the rest of this year, beginning February 1st, the off-peak toll rate for passenger vehicles would be 75 cents, which is down from $1.59. The peak hour toll rate for passenger vehicles will be $1, down from the planned $1.84. From January 1st, 2015 to December 31st, 2015, the off-peak toll rate for passenger vehicles will be $1. The peak hour toll rate for passenger vehicles will be $1.25. And from January 1st, 2016 until for that entire year, the toll rate for off-peak will be $1.25 and the peak hour will be $1.50. So what you have is tolls starting for peak rates at $1 going up a quarter each year. And then after that point in time, it will revert to the original contract that is stated in the agreement we have with our partners at Elizabeth River Crossings. Now, also, trucks will be helped. The off-peak toll rate for trucks will be three times the two-axle toll, and the peak hour toll rate for trucks will be four times the axle toll. So, in addition to our private citizens, businesses will also be helped by this toll rate. Now, this allows us several things to happen. One, it immediately brings relief to our citizens and our businesses. Two, since the tolls are staggered, for over the next 3 years, we will be able to get a good history of what diversion rates will be on this facility. As you all know, right now, we are negotiating with our partners on a projection, the projection in which this was built. And if you look across projects across the Commonwealth and across our country, there has typically been a substantial change of the actual vehicular count and the tolls that have been generated from the projection. So one thing this allows us to do is to get good history and good numbers on tolling should we continue to do things in the future. Now, one of the things that begins at the end of this flex schedule is that the state of Virginia, as part of the agreement, participates in any overages that may occur. And it is the intent of this administration and the Governor McAuliffe that any of those monies coming to us would be used to continue to mitigate tolls. So we're hopeful of two things. One, that we get a good history of what the tolling mechanism will generate in revenues. So if we continue to look at this issue, we'll be dealing from real numbers, not projections. And also, this will allow us to get the facility built. As you all know, per this contract, all the risk and construction of the facility is with our partners. So we will be. This will give them a chance to complete their construction and for us to take a look at what the real usage will be. I know there's been several economic impact reports done by Old Dominion University. There's one being proposed by the Transportation Planning Organization. And we hope to be able to get good data to not only deal with this particular project, but also other projects that may occur not only in Hampton Roads, but across our Commonwealth. Now, mitigating these tolls does not come without a price. It is expected that it will cost us a little over $82.5 million to buy these tolls down to these rates over the next 3 years. Now, we've just had a presentation on the six-year plan. And you all know that we have pretty much obligated everything in that plan to projects. So it was very important to the governor and to myself that we did not disrupt that plan, that it would not be a prudent use of other monies if we were to disrupt the current plan in place. So these tolls will be paid with in the following manner. First of all, there's $57.2 million of priority transportation funds from years 15 through 17 that have not been programmed. So those funds will go into paying for the mitigation of these tolls. As you recall, the priority transportation funds are designated for debt service and high priority projects. And the governor believes that this is one of the Commonwealth's most high priority projects as it supports not only our citizens, but it also supports our military. As we all know, Department of Defense is 50% of the Hampton Roads region's economy. So we do believe it is a high priority project. And as I said, these monies are not programmed, so there are no specific projects will be impacted by this $57.2 million. The other $25.3 million is planned from the proceeds of Garvey bonds. Many of the existing bonds have not been assigned to a specific project, and we talked about how those projects move for various reasons. So we were able to take this $25.3 million off of projects that have been moved back for other reasons, whether it's environmental, one I talked with Mr. Matthew before on, the Coalfields Expressway, the Pound Connector has moved because of just timing of the project, and so those monies will be used to pay this. I've given my word to Mr. Matney that those monies will be replaced in outer years when they're needed, so it will not impact the delivery of that project. So that's how these tolls will be paid for. And it would be my request today, and Mr. Miller in a few minutes is going to make a resolution, that the Commonwealth Transportation Board authorize the use of these funds to mitigate these tolls on the downtown Midtown Tunnel. Now, a couple of other comments. There have been many suggestions about alternative ways. One was that we should just cancel the contract. The Commonwealth of Virginia is open for business. We honor our contracts. It would send a terrible message to anyone else wanting to do business in the Commonwealth if we did not. And plus, there are so many penalties, as we've had a presentation before, it would cost us just as much in penalties as it would to get the contract completed. And I stated before that this is a desperately needed project for Hampton Roads.
The other suggestion was that we should somehow hold our private party concessionaire hostage to future work. I'll remind everyone we have procurement rules in the state of Virginia, and we were not going to penalize anybody for being the lowest bidder. But if you think about it logically, if this is such a great deal for the concessionaire, why would they want to give it up? And I'm not suggesting it is or it isn't. I'm just letting you know that that particular method does not make a lot of sense based on our procurement rules. And from our perspective, we believe we have good partners. They negotiated in good faith. Whether you think they got a good deal or a bad deal, they negotiated in good faith. And the state of Virginia will honor that. So when you look at all the different parameters and what was needed, we felt this was the most prudent and the best way to begin the process of dealing with tolls. And I say begin the process. There may be bills that we're aware of that will be targeted to socioeconomic individuals or other specific users. Those particular programs take time to implement, and they're best served through reimbursement, and our citizens need help up front. In fact, as I said, this is the only toll road in the state of Virginia's history that we've tolled before we had the capacity in place. In fact, it's even worse than that. We're actually taking some capacity away because of refurbishing the tunnel. So I wanted to let you know this was not something that wasn't thought through and taken into account not only the current citizens in Hampton Roads, particularly Norfolk and Portsmouth, but also all citizens of the Commonwealth to use the monies wisely and set us up as we begin to look at this issue in the future to be dealing with real numbers and not So with that, Mr. Miller, I would ask you if we could have a resolution. And, of course, we can either entertain questions before. I'm happy to do so before the resolution, or we can get a resolution in a second and entertain questions. So whatever. Let's go ahead and get the resolution in a second, and then we can open it up for questions, if that's okay with the board.
Mr. Chairman, as you know, I'm a resident of the city of Norfolk and have lived in this shadow of these projects my entire life. And it is my honor to support the governor and you and your plan by offering a motion for the following resolution, which I will read. This is a resolution of the Commonwealth Transportation Board dated January 15, 2014, tolling to the downtown Midtown Martin Luther King Expressway project. Whereas in December 2011, the Department of Transportation and Elizabeth River Crossings of OPCO LLC entered into a comprehensive agreement addressing the rehabilitation and construction of a project known as the Downtown Tunnel, Midtown Tunnel, Martin Luther King Extension Project. And whereas, pursuant to the terms of that comprehensive agreement, a toll rate schedule was established which provided for toll rates to be charged to various classifications of vehicles for various times of the day, including the peak hour toll rate. And whereas the toll rate schedule and timeline for initiating toll collection established a beginning date prior to construction of the project being complete in order to make the project financially feasible. And whereas, as the Commonwealth Transportation Board meeting in March 2012, the board passed a resolution providing additional funding to support the Commonwealth's contribution to the project. And whereas, following the CTB resolution, VDOT and ERC entered into an amendment number one to the comprehensive agreement, which amended the tolling provision within the comprehensive agreement to add a new subsection which allowed for the option to postpone the tolling of the existing project assets. And whereas in June 2012, the department gave notice to ERC of its intent to exercise its option to postpone the tolling commencement date. And whereas the June 2012 letter provided that in consideration of the postponement of the tolling commencement date until January 31, 2014, the department would pay into the public fund account of the comprehensive agreement the amount of $112,500,000 to support the design and construction of the project. And whereas the Secretary of Transportation has presented a proposal to this board, it summarized in attachment A hereto, in which he has proposed to reduce the toll rates beginning February 1, 2014, and whereas the board believes that the proposal lessens the financial impact of the tolls to the citizens and businesses in Hampton Roads, particularly in Portsmouth and Norfolk, and offers appropriate mitigation to those financial impacts, and whereas the board concurs with the secretary's proposal and believes funding should be transferred as set forth by the secretary in order to reduce the toll rate beginning February 1, 2014. Whereas the proposed funding, which would increase the public contribution to the design and construction of the project, will be transferred from the Garvey balance entry in the amount of $25,295,962. The balance of $57,246,038 will be funded from the priority trust fund revenue in the FY 2015-2020 six-year improvement program update, for a total of $82,542,000 to be added to the downtown tunnel, Midtown Tunnel, Martin Luther King Extension Project. Now, therefore, be it resolved by the Commonwealth Transportation Board that it hereby concurs with the proposal made this day by the Secretary of Transportation to increase the public contribution to support a reduced toll rate beginning on February 1, 2014, and be it further resolved that the board directs that the funds as set forth above be transferred, and further directs the commissioner to enter into whatever amendment to the comprehensive agreement is necessary in order to carry out the secretary's proposal.
Second.
We have a resolution, a first and a second. I will now open the floor for any discussion. Ms. Fisher.
The money that we're transferring will go towards construction. What about after construction with the reduced toll structure? I'm not familiar with the comprehensive agreement, so how does that fit into the return that the private partner is expected to get?
In effect, we are paying for the tolls, the difference between the stated rate and the lowered rate for the citizens, for the people who would use the facility.
Okay.
So for what
is the period?
For 3 years.
Okay.
And so that make a good point. There is some reduction of risk to the concessionaire because we're paying a part, and that was taken into account in negotiating this rate. Mr. Cole.
Secretary, do we have a sense as to what number of citizens this action affects?
We have a sense, and there have been several studies. I know at the Portsmouth Council meeting last night, there was an impact study done by Dr. Cook at Old Dominion University. And I've heard various ranges between 8 and 15%, depending on, you know, the level of population. But I will tell you what we do know, and those are all projections, and we're going to get good history, one of the reasons for staggering this. We do know that anybody making minimum wage or our service workers are significantly harmed by this. And that was intended to give immediate relief so we can get very good numbers of what we're dealing with. So to answer your question, there's some projections, but we don't have an accurate number.
But it's not an insignificant,
not
percentage
insignificant
of the region's population, right?
That's correct. Yes, that's correct, Mr. Cole. Mr. Whitworth.
Well, just for my information, would you explain to me a little bit on the priority trust fund? Is that now wiped out, or how do we fund that in the future?
Well, it's not wiped out, and those are some of the, we talked about earlier, the CTB schedule, but that, the revenues coming from that are from the revenues that come in through the state sales and that, you know, the uses, so it's not wiping it out at all. No. Yeah, it's just another flow through. Mr. Fraley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I fully intend to support this resolution. I think it's probably good. I think, if I understand right, I do need to point out that the money that is coming from the CTB formula is out of roads of statewide significance. Is that correct?
Out of the CTB formula. That's correct. That's correct.
And
that's right.
I have no doubt this is a road of statewide significance, and I do understand that the folks that are going to be using the road are still going to be paying and all that. I just want to point out that the Garvey bonds that we will be funding and using to fund this will be paid back by the entire Commonwealth. And I think, you know, we're not using the Hampton Roads fund to do that. And I understand why, and I get it. And I just wanted to make sure we're all aware.
That is a fair point, an accurate statement.
Mr. Peake.
Yes, Mr. Secretary, I just wanted to make a statement as well that when this contract was entered into, this was a priority of then Governor McDonnell. At that time, there had been no new revenue source in the Commonwealth for transportation for 20-plus years. There was no indication there was going to be any new revenue source anytime into the future. Hampton Roads area is vital to the Commonwealth, and traffic is a problem in Hampton Roads area. And this was seen as a way to help alleviate some of those problems and was supported by members of CTV who represented that area. This project was advertised. It was given notice. It was publicized. It was covered in the papers and the television. And I think it's a good project. And I know that people can criticize the contract, but at that time, I think tolls was the only way this project would get done, and currently is the only way this project would get done. There's been a lot of criticism after the contract was signed. And I find that somewhat unfortunate because there was plenty of time for public comment before the contract was signed, and it was not made. And it all happened afterwards as we got close to entering into the contract. And I just wish it had been those concerns had been raised before we entered into the contract and were proceeding. In spite of that, the Transportation Board, back in June of 2012, appropriated $112 million from the Commonwealth, the entire Commonwealth's money, to help alleviate some tolls. We've considered the project again. You're now proposing another $82 million that will also come out of the entire transportation system for the Commonwealth, over $200 million that we have ponied up in response to the complaints and criticisms that have arisen after this contract was entered into. I fully support the Secretary in this motion and the new governor. I understand he had problems with the contract that was entered into by the former governor. He won the election, and part of it was on helping to alleviate these tolls, and I think it's our obligation to look at this, and I think we have, and it does seem appropriate. So I fully support you and the new governor on this, but I want, we have responded. $200 million Commonwealth money to help alleviate these tolls. And so Hampton Roads is vital, and I think this shows our commitment to the Hampton Roads area.
Yes. Any other comments?
One last comment. I know time is short, Mr. Secretary. To Mr. Cole's point, there are over 1 million cars a month that use the Midtown facility. That does not include the MLK. It does not include the downtown tunnel. So that's 1 million a month. So it's many millions of trips, probably about 25 million trips or more in a year's time. So it is hugely significant.
Mr. Hollis?
Yes.
Mr. Ellis, excuse me.
Yes. Just wanted to add, let me get a chance to say anything on this motion here, but I just want to have full support of Mr. Secretary and the Governor in this proposal. I do know that I've heard several constituents do something about it, so I'm in full support of any other proposals that we may have going forward in the future in order to any sort of mitigation.
Mr. Chairman, I call the question.
Question has been called. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you very much, fellow members. I appreciate it very much, the Governor. I appreciate it, and we thank you for your support.
It's kind of interesting in 1960. Start out to yourself. 64 was complete. $200 million. Put that total together. Now we've got $200 million just to alleviate tolls. What is that total project expected to cost?
Yeah. I remember that. Back in the 60s. We just went out there.
64.
Yeah.
It looks like it's going to be about 5 or 10 minutes, so why don't we begin the public comment, and if we'll please ask you, if you're in mid-sentence and he shows, we'll ask you to be seated, but we'll now go into public comment. If there would anybody like to address our board, would you please come forward? Yes. All right. Thank you for coming today.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Kenny Wright. I'm the mayor of the city of Portsmouth, and I bring you greetings on behalf of 98,000 extremely disappointed people, and disappointed from the standpoint of this board and any other agency that had something to do with crafting this contract and this deal without doing a thorough impact analysis on what it would do to this region and to all of the communities. Because if this project is that important, and I think we all agree that it is, why wouldn't we take the time to do an analysis and see who would be damaged and how do we make them whole? And the city of Portsmouth is the smallest within that region and the poorest. And my city spent $18,000 to pay for probably the most prominent economic person in this Commonwealth to do an impact study that showed that the poorest city in that region would be impacted 8 times the richest city, which is Virginia Beach. 8 times. And to answer your question, sir, there are 31,000 people that have to go through that tunnel every day from Portsmouth to Norfolk. And that 8 times factor is based on the job market, the economy, and all of these variables. And the thing that was so critical and it was so damaging to my city is that equates to 52% of the jobs in Portsmouth. So when this thing goes into effect, 52% of the jobs in my city could come unravel. People could move, relocate, all of the above. That's 52%. 8 times, and there's not one person in this Commonwealth has come to me or anybody in my city to say we understand this impact and the importance of this deal is so great to the Commonwealth and to Hampton Roads that here are some of the things that we want to do to make it up to you. We're losing property forever off of our tax rolls. So while we stand here, I got mixed emotions. I am extremely pleased with this new governor and his efforts, and very excited about our new secretary and you too, Charlie. And it's just the fact that we're not taking this bull by the horns and looking at this contract over the next 58 years is disturbing, but I am relieved with this initial first step, and I am relieved that you said this is a first step, Aubrey, and I'm looking forward to that. But the impact on my city, the city of Portsmouth, 8 times. And again, you're talking about, you mentioned socioeconomics and all of those types of things, and how ironic that we're here on the birth of Dr. Martin Luther King, who made that famous statement that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And each of you are from communities very similar to mine. To have this type of impact and this type of injustice to the city of Portsmouth and not one person on this board and not one person in any of those agencies says, what is the impact? It is extremely disturbing. So again, I want to applaud you for this first effort, and I was hoping to go back to the city of Portsmouth with some better news to those 98,000 people, because we truly believe in making this Commonwealth and this region the best that it can be, but we don't want to leave anyone behind. And if we are doing damage or doing any type of harm to any neighborhood, city, region, we want to make sure it's right, because economically, if it makes sense, we want to support it in the city of Portsmouth. Mr. Secretary, thank you.
Thank you, Mayor Wright, for your comments.
I actually brought this copy for you, sir. This is a hand delivered from the Mayor of Portsmouth.
Thank you very much. I will accept it.
Transportation Board for this unanimous vote. This is obviously very important. I want to thank Secretary Aubrey Lane for his outstanding leadership, not only on this issue, but on all the other issues that we are presently working on. This was a very important project for me. I talked about this a lot. I know the mayor is here. We talked a lot about the tolls. I think everybody in this room realizes that I am a huge supporter. Public-private partnerships. I support tolling, and as I mentioned at the State of the Commonwealth address Monday evening, I support them. But they have to be fair. They have to be equitable. They have to take in the interest of what makes the best sense for the citizens being affected. How does it affect quality of life? And this Midtown project, I've said from the start, those tolls were just too high. They impacted people's lives, it could have affected commerce, it clearly would have affected quality of life issues, so I appreciate this vote here today. This is lowering it down to 75 cents off-peak and a dollar on peak. This is a good first step for us. This buys us some time to do what we need to do. I've never been a fan of this deal. This type of deal will never, ever see the day of light in a McAuliffe administration. Thank you, Mayor. It just was not in the best interest of the Commonwealth of Virginia. It's not a deal we would ever do. But as governor, I'm bound by this agreement. We have to honor our commitments as the Commonwealth, but we have to do what we have to do to make it easier on the citizens in the Commonwealth. So this is a great first step. I thank all of you for your vote. We're looking forward to working with you on the many projects that we have. The goal is, obviously, with some transportation funding money, to make sure we're delivering our projects on time and on budget and do this as efficiently as possible. And that is our goal. We have a lot of needs, but let's make sure we're doing these projects, number one, to ease congestion, number two, should have an economic development component to it, and number three, let's have local say and local government say, and the folks who are affected by these projects should have some say in these projects. So I am excited. This was a very important campaign pledge that I made, and I'm just thankful to everybody here that we could get out of the box running in my first week and do something that we promised we would do. So I thank you for this opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Governor. There'll be a 5-minute recess, everyone.
All right, folks, if everybody could take a seat, we're going to start back. The secretary has told me I can drive the bus for a few minutes until he comes back in the room, so we're going to get restarted here.
Mr. Chairman? Just a point of clarification, because I know a bunch of y'all weren't here when we went through some of these, when this contract was approved and so forth. And whether you're a fan of the contract or whether you're not a fan of the contract, The fact is that CTB never took a vote on this contract or on this deal until the deal was signed and inked and done. It was not a deal that came before this board, although we were aware of it, certainly, and we had some information about it. We never saw the contract. We weren't involved in that. It was signed and a done deal without CTB involvement because it was allowed to be. Some of us, including me, took issues with various provisions of it, and I spoke at length about the impact to the residents of Portsmouth as well as Norfolk. There are about 33,000 trips a day in the Midtown Tunnel, which is the one tube tunnel at this point, and that makes it the busiest two-lane highway east of the Mississippi. The real issue for the folks that are concerned about it is that there is no reasonable alternative for them to get across the water, particularly during any kind of rush hour, other than using these facilities. And if you just sort of think logically about it, and I'm not trying to bash the deal, but if you think logically about it, do you think bondholders would buy bonds for toll facilities if there were reasonable alternatives to go around them? Well, if you had a reasonable alternative to go around it, you'd go around it, and there would be no toll revenue. So those who put this deal together understand that there is no reasonable alternative. Mr. Malbin, hailed new member from our region, understands that if you live in downtown Portsmouth and you work at the Naval Base or Sentara or downtown, to go all the way around 664 and try to fight your way through the high-rise bridges or go across the Tolt Jordan Bridge or now the Gilmanton Bridge, I mean, it's just not a reasonable situation for folks. So that's why they're so exercised about it. To Mr. Peake's point, and I'm going to shut up and let you move on when you meet, Mr. Chairman. To Mr. Peake's point, I might make the case that the whole billion too should have been financed by the Commonwealth, not just $200 million of additional money. I'm ecstatic. I would disagree with Mayor Wright that none of us talked to him or anybody else about it, because we did. But just understand that it was not a CTB action. We didn't have an opportunity to weigh in on a vote on this project one way or the other, except after it was done. And as you recall, if you were here, we did that to backstop the legal situation that we were facing. So we actually did vote on the project after the project contract was finalized. I think it was a couple months later that we came back in this room and voted on it, but it was after the deal was done. So those are the facts as it relates to that. I'm ecstatic and happy that we found some relief for those folks, because for some folks, it's not going to impact me or my way of life, but for some folks, you know, you take $28,000 a year of income and you say it's now going to cost you $1,100 after tax just to keep going to work, that's a huge impact. It's a huge impact. So I salute the Secretary and the Governor and everybody else that had a hand in it, and I look forward to their next steps.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Any other public comment to come before the board this afternoon? Okay, hearing none, then we'll move on to our action item agenda. The first is in the maintenance division, Mr. Helsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got two Fritz namings. One is in Loudoun County, the other is in the town of Hillsville and Carroll County. Both of those are in proper water. They've been brought to us with resolutions from the localities, and the division is recommending the approval of both.
Motion.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Gazinski. Now we have Mr. Brule.
Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I have a resolution before you to deallocate funds from projects in the revenue sharing program. This is part of our annual review process. We've worked very closely with local government over the last 6 months to identify 24 projects totaling approximately $4.6 million, where the most of them are from completed or canceled projects where we can roll that money back into the program to help fund the request.
Is there a motion?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
Second?
Okay, second. Any comments? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Cole. Ms. Mitchell.
Good afternoon. I have two items for you. The first item is the addition of projects to the six-year improvement program. There are several projects on here, but most of those are really just breaking out specific projects from two line items that are already in the program that are related to the CTB formula ITS formula funding. If you have any questions about the additions, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Is there a motion?
No.
Ms. Fisher, no move. Thank you. A second?
Second.
Thank you, Mr. Ellis. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
The second item is the action on the monthly transfers. This is our normal item we bring to you each month. Most of these transfers are moving surplus money from completed projects or moving surpluses to projects that where it is needed or to close them out. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer them.
Any questions of Ms. Mitchell?
Move approval, Mr. Chairman.
All move. Thank you. Second?
Second.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Any opposed? Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Bennett. Good to see you today, Mr. Bennett.
Line item number six is a proposed limited access break. It's in Fairfax County at the intersection of Route 7 and 123. And it's actually located on Route 7 just to the west of that interchange. This is a proposed break to facilitate a development of that parcel in that quadrant of the intersection. It's based upon a review of that development by Fairfax County and determining appropriate proper conditions with that. They are requesting that a central roadway be built in order to facilitate the movement. The developer would add a lane to Route 7, and our traffic engineering people have determined that it would function better than it does now, you know, with that change. So we're recommending that this limited access break be granted.
Mr. Karzynski?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend to my fellow board members that we adopt the resolution on the limited control change. This is something that has been endorsed by the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors wholeheartedly. A lot of work put in by the Northern Virginia District, and also by Rick Walton and Garrett Moore from Central Office as well. It will be the springboard for the first development piece in the new Tyson's Corner area. It's right by the Greensboro Metro stop, and so I move the resolution, Mr. Chairman.
Second.
First and second, any comments?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with the resolution. I want to raise again, you know, when we do these, if I understand what this is, it's breaking the limited access portion, and the more we do that, the reason it has to come to our attention, I assume, is because it's a fairly drastic action. And the more we do that around the Commonwealth, the quicker we turn our roads into traffic stoplights. And so, understand, I just want to... Yeah.
Right.
Well, it is, Mr. Farrell, in this particular instance, it's a slight move of the limited access that portends better for the layout of this whole complex, which is a grid street complex. You're probably not familiar with Clyde's up in Northern Virginia, but it's right on that Route 7, 123. And I do understand your concern, and it's legitimate, but in this case, it is for the betterment, and I think the Board of Supervisors acknowledge that when they pass.
Okay. There's a very detailed process in the Board's regulations that we look at least 7 or 8 different elements before we would ever consider recommending one.
Any other questions?
It should be noted this is not a break of the main line. This is actually a break of a ramp coming off that actually helps clear the main line. So we're keeping the integrity of the through lanes. This is a limited access break at an interchange that is allowing the main line to clear faster.
All right, well, I mean, we're getting ready to just roll through this thing.
All right, right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All right.
You have to see the site plan.
Mr. Page.
Abbott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. Item 7 before you is an action item on the Industrial Access Railroad Tracks Fund for the Department of Rail and Public Transportation. Bayshore Concrete Incorporated, this is not only a feel-good story, but also a really good story about the Eastern Shore of Virginia. Bayshore Concrete has been the largest employer in Northampton County. It's been an anchor and mainstay also for the provisions of bridge products and other construction materials for concrete. One of the biggest customers that they have right now is an exclusive opportunity for them to construct nuclear vaults. As you know, our nuclear power plants across the United States and also the Department of Defense have spent nuclear material that has to be stored appropriately. And Bayshore Concrete has the opportunity now not only to increase its capacity on site for its normal concrete operations, but also get more intense into the construction of these vaults that weigh 100 tons apiece. The rail access grant that we're talking about today will increase and enhance the access to their terminal. In association with this, we will double the size of the jobs that are at Northampton County, which is directly associated with this $4.1 million overall capital investment. They right now will be shipping in excess of 240 additional rail cars annually. They ship today 68 rail cars. Of the 90 jobs today, we will create 110 new jobs on top of that. And incorporated with this is a $524,764 rail improvement, which Bayshore Concrete has asked for the Commonwealth's participation through the rail fund of $412,382. As a part of that, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, includes a local match provision of $112,382 that's going to be provided by Bayshore Concrete. And also, in addition to this, Mr. Chairman, just a point of reference for you. This is item 7 on your workshop agenda that I just ran through for you. So, in essence, to the benefits of the adjustment of the schedule, you don't have to hear me again in item 7 if it's your choice, sir.
Any questions of Mr. Page?
Make a motion.
Is there a motion?
I make a motion and would say, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Page, I appreciate particularly the additional data that you're giving to us now about jobs and economic impact. As you know, I've been one of your questioners about those things. Obviously, this investment has huge returns in terms of jobs and economic impact to a particularly distressed area of our Commonwealth, Northampton County. So I'm glad to make the motion to approve this.
Second.
We have a second. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Page, I guess we're down now to scheduling contract. Mr. James.
Yeah, Secretary Lane, Commissioner Kilpatrick, members of the board. Let me first say that in 2013, we procured and advertised 16% more than we did in 2012. And to that end, I'm requesting approval to let two contracts over $5 million, D21 and D55. You have the ballot before you.
You want to take these all as one?
Yes.
Can I have a motion, please?
So moved.
So moved. A second?
Second.
And I have one other item, which is design
well,
build.
Okay. Let
I'm sorry.
All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. Approved. Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay. I have one design bid, design build project worth $9.8 million, Rolling Road, Franconia Springfield Parkway, and I'm requesting approval to award that.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Okay, is there any other action to come before us this afternoon? I'll remind us we're going to go back after this and to finish our workshop. Okay, the action item session is now complete, and we will go back to the workshop items. I think we stopped with Mr. Gruhl. Was due up.
Mr. Chairman, I will be very brief. I want to give you an update on our revenue sharing program. For those who may not be familiar with the revenue sharing program, it's established in the Code of Virginia and provides the opportunity to match localities' contributions to a project on a dollar-for-dollar basis, which basically is a 50-50 split of a project cost. The maximum allocation that the board can make to the program on an annual basis is up to $200 million, and the maximum that a locality can apply for is $10 million. Of that $10 million, they can use up to $5 million for maintenance projects that meet the priority criteria. The code also provides us with two priority tiers. Priority one is given to projects where The locality can accelerate an advertisement date for a project that's either in the six-year program or in their local capital improvement plan. And next priority is given to pavement resurfacing and bridge rehabilitation projects where that infrastructure is below the department's maintenance performance targets. Everything else that doesn't meet those priority criteria goes to priority tier three. We go through a formal application process each year. We issued our call for applications back in August with an application deadline of November 1st. We received applications from 79 localities requesting over $183 million in matching funds. Nine localities did request the maximum of $10 million. And as we have seen in the past, the majority of the requests do fall into that Tier 1 advancing construction and improvement project. Next slide just gives you a breakdown of the district requests. We do see good geographic distribution with the program, so that can tell you how many localities have applied and the total request for your district. If your district has an asterisk by it, that indicates that the district has localities that have applied for that $10 million max.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that part.
If you have an asterisk by your district, which yours would have, yours don't?
No,
it does not. You don't have any localities that applied for $10 million. You had your localities made requests, but they can make requests at any amount. The next slide gives us kind of the picture of what this program really does. When I indicated that the program by code is a dollar-for-dollar match, you would automatically think that when the localities request $183 million, we match it with $183 million, and that's the total value of the program. But in fact, we've seen over the years that that's not the case. If you look at their state match request, their local match request just for this fiscal year, and then look at all of the other funding that is already applied to these projects, whether it's other state money, federal money in some cases, local private developer funding, the actual total value for the projects that we've received requests for is almost $840 million. This program is a great leveraging of our state resources with local, federal, and private funds to deliver these transportation projects. Next graphic just gives you an idea of which localities have applied, which localities want to participate in the program. We are seeing better geographic distribution this year than we have in the past. An example of that is Lynchburg District, which had, I don't think, any applications last year. Districts made a great effort to reach out to those localities, promote the program, and they've come to the table this year with more requests. I can skip through the next couple of slides because you just took action on the deallocation program. But the deallocation is established in code. We have a CTV policy that governs that. We go through quite an extensive process to make sure that what we bring you is truly ready for deallocation. And in closing, what we received was a little over $183 million in requests. And as Ms. Fisher indicated in her presentation earlier, we're recommending to the board allocation to match the full request to fully fund the program for fiscal year 15. In terms of deallocation, we will apply that amount that we have deallocated from projects today to help offset those requests as well. We would bring those requests to you for action in June in conjunction with the six-year program. So they will be part of the draft six-year program that goes out for the public hearing.
Mr. Roll,
yes, Mr.
Can I clarify something? With the deallocation does not go back to the district, it goes back to the general fund?
No, sir. It goes back to the overall program to offset any requests. There are no
questions. Any questions of Ms. Rule?
Mr. Secretary.
Oh, Mr. Whitcourt.
We officially take action on this in June, is that correct?
That's correct.
And the reason why we wait for June is what?
We used to time our application cycle so that it was closer to June. We shifted a few years back to accepting applications in the fall because it provided us an opportunity to work with Mr. Lawson and Ms. Busher to try to fully fund the program, make adjustments in the budget like we're doing this time to be able to fully fund the request. So we do it very early, and then we wait until those funds become available with the fiscal year July 1st to actually.
So even if we were to approve it earlier than June, the money wouldn't be available till July.
The money still would not be available till July.
Anything else? Okay, Mr. Rule, thank you very much. Here we go. Easy pass issuance in Hampton Roads.
Oh, boy.
That's it. All the cameras have left.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board.
Good afternoon.
I'll be brief also. The presentation is intended to provide you the latest experience that we've had in Hampton Roads over the last, particularly the last 2 weeks. Remind the board of the goals we started out with, give the status, talk about the early distribution challenges, and talk about how we're prepared. In your packages also, there's the BDOT marketing plan, and that actually went into effect January 6th. Emma Rollison, our Director of Communications, if there's any questions, she can address those questions. As we started out, back in November, we informed the board that we had a goal of 275,000 new transponders in the region by February 1st. This was based on a 50% penetration rate as provided with ERC's help. The other goals were to establish a strong EasyPass retail program in the region, open two new customer service centers, one in Portsmouth side, one on Norfolk side, execute our VDOT marketing EasyPass plan, and ensure customer service. The path to the 75,000 new transponders in the region by February 1st. If you take a snapshot on October 31st, 2013, there was 128,000 transponders in the region. For us to meet our 75,000 transponder goal by February 1st, that number will grow to 203,000. To date, we, since November 1st, have distributed 42,000 transponders. Since January, we've done 27,000, that's of course included in that 42,000 number. And so if you look at the remainder for our goal, we're at 33,000 between now and February 1st. Have you obtained a transponder? We have five retailers in the region providing 20 locations. We, as I mentioned, we've got two of our new customer service centers, one in Norfolk, one in Portsmouth. We had an existing customer service center at Pullman Bridge. We've also teamed up with some of our other partners for three co-locations, ERT being one of them, Chesapeake Bay Bridge, and Chesapeake DMV. Currently, our CSEs at Norfolk and Portsmouth and the ERT are open 7 days a week. And we have the capacity at those CSEs to handle 1,500 transactions a day. Online is probably our most preferred method. Currently, we're seeing 65% of the transponder requests or account activity online. That's 24/7. We've increased that web capacity tenfold. We also have our phone systems that are open 7 days a week now, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. We brought in additional staff resources to help man the phones. Our capacity with the phones and the web is 4,000 transponders, giving us our overall capacity on a daily basis of 5,500 transponders a day. We're also teaming up with our ERC partners and participating in some of the community events. There was a large auto show last weekend. 327 transponders were distributed there. We had two events at OEU, resulting in 303 on the first event. Newport New Shipbuilding, four events scheduled. Highwater Community College, four events also scheduled. And we've got an event scheduled for the Naval Medical Center and North State University. This is the graph. This was the plan. The green line represents our anticipated volume on a weekly basis. The red line is our actual up until current up to last week. You can see it was relatively flat back in November through December, and then it really started to increase on a weekly basis after the new year. If we look at a cumulative approach, you can see that green line again is our projected demand. The red line is our actual, and you can see we're kind of back on the curve. There was a period there over the holidays that we fell off the curve. We're back on the curve now.
Is this a cumulative curve, or this is, in other words, we're not back on where we thought we'd be in total? Or is this a cumulative curve showing that we're back to where we thought we'd be, just got there a different way?
We still got to make up that ground on the gap of that curve, so we're not there yet.
Our rate is going to what we thought, but right. We haven't made up the difference so far.
Exactly right, Mr. Secretary.
Okay.
meeting the increased demand. We've actually located some of our inventory in the Portsmouth area, and if a retailer calls us and says they're out of stock, depending on the urgency, then we can just turn over there and make a matter of hours to refill their stock or their inventory. As far as addressing the wait times at the customer service centers, we've used an expedited approach where we collect the application, the fee, and provide the transponder, entering that data at our slower period. We also provided on-the-go kits, so if someone doesn't want to fill out the application, they can take one of our own on-the-go kits, purchase that for $35, and be out the door, registering on the web or the phone sometime after that. On those on-the-go kits, just as a reminder, when you purchase those $35 on-the-go kits, you got $15 immediately to utilize to pay tolls. The remaining $20 is also there to pay tolls, but to get to that $20, you'll need to register that transponder and open an account. We're trying to expand our retail network. We've got local governments showing interest. In fact, I think Suffolk signed this morning, and they have two locations. We also continue to seek additional opportunities. The transponder inventory on hand, 96,000 as of Monday. Transponders are on hand with 37,000 due for a January delivery. And our on-the-go packages, we're at 55,000 currently, and expect 26,000 more by the end of the month. I'll be brief on these. This is a picture of our new customer service center in Norfolk that opened December 2nd. The unique thing about this facility is we also provide fulfillment of our transponder orders out of this location, which also reduces that delivery time in the mail side of the facility. The Portsmouth Customer Service Center, that's in the Victory Crossing Shopping Center. That's our busiest location, almost double what we were doing at the Norfolk Center. And it's very busy. That was the one yesterday. We set significant, or not yesterday, Monday at the close of the promotion. There was our biggest day ever. If you look at the transponders for that day, we had 4,500 distributed in that one day. Retail locations, prior to November 1st, we had two retailers, and that's moved to six. And the number of locations have gone from six to 20. And then to count the Suffolk contract, you can add one more to the retailer and two more locations. This is a list of those locations. It doesn't have Suffolk in it yet. And this is the latest brochure that also gives the way that you can obtain your transponders, also the locations where you can pick one up. Secretary, that concludes my report.
Any questions, Mr. Yes, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. We have struggled, as you know, and Aubrey's predecessor, the Secretary's predecessor, talked to us numerous times about our struggle getting these things out. We sort of bought some time when we postponed tolls and so forth and so on. We continue to struggle with, you know, the website had some issues where it was overwhelmed. Sounds familiar. But we got ours back pretty quickly, I think. The retail locations have struggled sort of out of the box in terms of setting some up. And obviously all that sort of leads to exacerbating the unhappiness about some of the tolls at the end. I'm curious as to whether we ever asked DMV to distribute these things as well. I mean, we've got plenty of local offices. I know we signed up some treasurer's offices and other things, but here we got an agency of the Commonwealth inside the Secretariat, and they have offices certainly in Hampton Roads. And I know they haven't been offering Easy Pass. Is there a reason for that?
Mr. Bill, that's a good point. Actually, we have been in contact with Commissioner Holcomb's staff. We're trying to put together that agreement. They had some challenges with not having the budget allocated this fiscal year. We're still trying to work through how we can get those transponders at their locations. There's a memorandum of understanding that's been worked on for the last 2 months, and hopefully we can get something with them going. There are a number, I think there's at least 10 locations in that area. It would be a great partnership.
Yeah, and obviously, not to bash how we got here or to beat up on you guys, but DMV has been part of the Secretariat since the last 4 years anyway, and it's sort of, I bet you Mr. Secretary Lane could probably help you negotiate that agreement.
Okay, very good.
We've already had that discussion. The couple things to note. First of all, our partners from Elizabeth River Crossings have extended their promotion on Easy Pass to the end of this month through January 31st. So they have been working hand in hand with us. The reason I asked the question earlier is because I know at the last CTV meeting there was discussion about this. It's been a lot of publicity. I know we've remedied some of those issues in that regard, but I think we've got some more work to do, although I know we're staying on top of it. It seems to be going smoothly now. The real issue that Ms. Miller, you point to is what's the right agency suited to dealing with these issues and the whole bit? And I think we'll find Mr. Kilpatrick. We're all in this for together, and we'll work together in that regard. That's not to suggest that what we did wasn't right. It just suggests that we had a lot going on in that regard. So, and the toll case did not help a lot in terms of people, and they're going to need transponders for a while. So, to make a long story short, we've been working with Elizabeth River in terms of non-compliance and the programs that they're working with. So I'm satisfied that where we are now, we're on the right path. We'll see if it's too little, you know, when we get there, but I know we're doing what we're supposed to be doing now. Mr. Cole, you had...
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. I'll share a comment that Mr. Cuddell and I had offline. One of the things we're doing in the Richmond region, we're adding parking space at our Amtrak station on Staples Mill Road, and we're adding, that's fee parking there, and we're adding for the first time an Easy Pass exit so that customers with Easy Pass can use it. And I think that makes all the sense in the world. The more that we can get Easy Pass to possess a utility function, then I think it makes the challenges that we're facing trying to get up to a certain point. So I'm not sure in the Tidewater area whether there are similar type of opportunities for us to try to make that Easy Pass thought of as something other than just something to use in a bridge or tunnel facility or an Easy Pass.
Right. Yes, Mr. Cole, the Easy Pass has an Easy Pass Plus that actually is working in other IAG agencies that utilize that transponder for parking. So it's not like, you know, it hasn't been established. It is a working scenario. So.
Mr. Ellis?
Mr. Chairman, my understanding was, I believe from some previous meetings on this, that there was an issue with staffing, as far as, you know, manning and placing someone in DMV, you know, to actually sell the transponder later. And that was the reason why.
Well, there was two approaches. We actually have a partnership with one DMV in Chesapeake where we're working side by side. We have our own terminal that gets us into our Easy Pass account. I think a more lucrative partnership as far as the customer is concerned is to allow them to be on the retail program. So when you're in there transacting business for your vehicle, you see a $35 retail package, then they physically, we don't have to staff that. They can use their own staff to provide that.
Mr. Chairman, my name
yes,
is Ash.
Yes,
you know, to both of your points, we did look to DMV back when we were ramping up for the hot lanes, and we opened a DMV, you know, in Tysons, and what we have found is, you know, be surprised to everyone, people don't like to go to DMV, and we aren't doing that much business at DMV. And after a period of time and after the hot lanes opened, we actually pulled out of the DMV in Tyson. Because as David was saying, the way we work with DMV because of error air back office contract is that we actually have to put dedicated staff in the DMV office to run and issue the transponders. So what we have been doing recently, is which David mentioned, is in order to have a broader coverage, is to try to get to bring DMV on board as a retailer. So they can just have an inventory of transponders and many, many, many stores that will be available to the public as they prefer to come in and choose. And it doesn't require having people there, you know, additional people there waiting for someone to come in.
Yes. Based on all of these updates we've gotten over the past number of years, I've not heard a single comment that people are out here trying to buy the transponders and we can't meet their demand.
Because you don't live in Hampton.
Yeah, right? They are in Hampton. That's been. Is that the issue?
Mr. Chairman, yes. What I sort of glossed over, but there have been issues. There have been a fair amount of reports about it. Originally, the website got overwhelmed. There aren't that many, as you know, locations. We're still substantially behind the curve on a February 1 date. We're 15 days away from that.
Keep saying how many
so
we want.
Here's what's going to happen at the end of the day. People are going to start getting notices when they don't have their transponders, and it's going to be big money. And they're going to go nuts.
That's going to
occur because it's just human, we're humans. So the faster we can get these things out and get them available to people, the better it's going to be for everybody. And they're working on it. I'm not beating anybody up. But there is.
They
don't read about Lynchburg because it's not an issue.
Well, I haven't heard of it in our updates. And that was my thought. They're just not getting them. But they're trying to get them, and they're not available.
We'll do a better job of the updates.
They're trying to get them, and we haven't been able to get them supplied.
We ran out of them. There's a bunch of folks that have applied to Massachusetts.
We just didn't get them down.
Because we ran out of them in those locations. So now people are going there and they don't have any. And that's even, that's like, wow.
This is something that's just come up within the last 3 weeks or so. It hasn't been that long since the last week.
Well, yeah, my interpretation, and I'm sorry, because I felt like people just weren't getting them because they didn't need them yet.
We've been questioning the approach for, about 18 months. The lawsuit but I think we're on the right track. There have been instances because we've doubled or tripled, but unlike what happened at the national level, we got the website right the next day, I think. I mean, it got that working in that regard. Our partners, to Mr. Miller's comments, we have been working with them about what may happen for noncompliance. They are, without disclosing their business plans, they have a plan. But I'm asking everybody to please get your transponder. But there are issues that they understand that. And even as far as working with the local judges in terms of as we go through this. So, because you see the target was only 50% penetration to begin with. I'm comfortable that where we are now, not where we've been, but where we are now, we're doing the right things to get this going.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, ma'am.
I believe Transurban on the 495 express lane gave some period of grace at the beginning for people that were in violation. They sent notices and they were required to pay the tolls and maybe a small administration fee, but they didn't immediately start with the fines. And I wonder if we've approached Elizabeth River about doing something similar, say, for the first 2 weeks or first month as it's ramping up.
Without disclosing their plans, because you don't want to, they're very much aware of that. Yes. Yes. I did have one question. There was an article about this Massachusetts website.
Yes.
That people found there wasn't, it was cheaper or wasn't a fee. And there was an issue with that. Are we aware of all that?
Yeah, we actually sent a request to the IAG to canvass the entire membership and requested how many, since November 1st, Virginia residents are purchasing transponders from those outside, out of Virginia locations. And, that Massachusetts was one of the larger ones.
Right.
Delaware is another one. What we're telling folks is that, Virginia, and service your account, once you go outside Virginia Easy Pass, we don't own those accounts. To service those accounts, you have to deal with those other agencies.
And also, you may not be provided any promotional benefits with an out-of-state account like that. So,
if I could add, I've directly spoken with the toll road operator in Massachusetts, and what all they were doing, they're not turning away anyone, but what they were doing was just trying to educate the public that if they are asking for an account in Virginia, just make sure that they understand that, as David was saying, that you may not be eligible for any Virginia-based promotion, and understand that your servicing of your account can't be done in person. That's one of the local stores. So I actually have a copy of the letter. I'll be glad to give you that they have been sending
out. You're on top of it. I just see the report. Yeah. We're dealing with it. Okay, any other comments on Easy Pass? All right, before we, I think this is the last item for today, I wanted to, first of all, go back. We were quick with Mr. Malvin when he came in. His father actually served, I believe, on the Highway Commission before. So he'll hit the ground running in that regard. But
I knew the acronym was.
Yeah. But I think they it was, and he got back on now, I guess, when we have money again, so in that regard. So welcome, John, welcome you to our board. I know you want to get with Carol, Ms. Mathis here, and you know, and get some orientation set up to meet people so you know where you're going. And I wanted to, oh, yes, Ms. Cole.
Mr. Secretary, I thought I'd also point out to the group that John also has a royalty connection with our secretary, as they were both former King Neptune.
Also, when you're talking about money royalties.
That's right.
And I want to thank again the board today for the having to change up everything and working through us, and I appreciate your support for the governor in that. But I heard all your comments, and we will be prudent. Yes.
Mr. Chairman, we are very proud of you. Thank you for doing it.
Well, thank you. I look forward to working with everybody. Got a good team in place here, and I look forward to working with everyone and all the new guys on board. As I got an email from the governor that's on January 1st. He says, buckle up. The next 4 years, you're not going to sleep much. So anyway, with that, if this and anything else, we'll adjourn. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Take care. Hope all.